What General Vagon has called the Battle of France is over. The Battle of Britain is about to begin. Upon this battle depends the survival of Christian civilization. Upon it depends our own British life and the long continuity of our institutions and our empire. The whole fury and might of the enemy must very soon be turned on us. Hitler knows that he will have to break us in this island or lose the war. If we can stand up to him, all Europe may be freed, and the life of the world may move forward into broad, sunlit uplands. But if we fail, then the whole world, including the United States, including all that we have known and cared for, will sink into the abyss of a new dark age, made more sinister and perhaps more protracted by the lights of perverted science. Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duty, and so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its commonwealths last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour.
This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. Well, not quite 5 o'clock. It's 5 minutes past 5 on Friday, the 9th of May, 2025. And Not the BCFM Politics Show is streaming live from a corner of freedom close by Bristol city centre. Don't believe a word we say. As we do our best to share a few bits of clarity, just check it for yourself. We're speaking to you from Bristol's Templar Port, turned merchant venture fortress in Champon's Charlie's Empire of Lies. On VE Week, the 80th, we are live on the talkradio.org.uk stream, DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire. And I noticed, actually, that RadioQ.UK.com are back on again. Apparently he's managed to get himself another hosting system, which isn't costing him an absolute fortune every 5 seconds. So maybe back there soon. But also we're live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, which is in the process of, I'm trying now to get a, in fact I'll be putting them up on the this week and subsequent week's show pages, a much better download place, because I've been downloading it for friends and family and things like that and getting it on there. They've asked me, oh, I can't do it, you know, so, and I realised that the site that we were given is not actually very easy to use, and there's lots of ads on there that are trying to pretend to be download links and things like that. So we're going to make it nice and easy. So all part of the service, so it is, the app is available free from APK Pure or the Apple App Store, but not the evil Google Play. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its zero trust agenda psyops, bending our minds with sophisticated distortions, or boring us to tears with irrelevant distractions, puff pieces on the conspirators and hatchet jobs on the hero. The so-called solutions to multiplying crises, Gaza, Ukraine, COVID, migrants, oh yes, Lebanon and all that stuff as well now, prisons, farming, cost of living, NHS, sun dimming, yeah right, the twisted Armageddonist, accelerationist policies crafted to make every crisis worse. I don't know how people haven't noticed this, a lot of people haven't noticed, but that's actually the policy now, is to make everything worse, to come up with a rubbish solution. Well, it's not just a rubbish solution, it's a perverse solution. And all the politicians have nothing to say. Nick Land's techno-behaviourist dark enlightenment cowards and control freaks want us as slaves to the AI. Or dead, maybe. Albert Pike's World War III relies on blind obedience. Meanwhile, wife-murdering, pantheist, weft king and vampire queen Carmella wage war on China, Russia and the BRICS, as well as the British people. And the Crown prosecutes us for praying. And the only right they seem interested in is our so-called right to kill ourselves with the help, like with the jabs, of a friendly doctor. But it's not the end of the world. Or is it? So as we learn, you learn. So helping us navigate the WEF's Fourth Reich is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and local activist also Matt O'Brannan's joining us as well today. So we've had a three-day build-up to Thursday's VE Day commemoration yesterday, but now they've forgotten all the lessons, haven't they? Even worse, King Charles is working hard to start World War III. Hey, that's great, King. We'll be hearing from him, and we'll be hearing from Vlad, his arch-enemy. This programme has revealed the British royal family of Saxe-Coburg-Gotha turned a family squabble into World War I. We also, that was revealed by many people. It was a family squabble, the three cousins that started World War I, and collaborating with Hitler's treasurer come Private Secretary Martin Bormann at the close of World War II to launder the billion or so dollars the Nazis had looted from occupied Europe. MI6 and the CIA also spawning the Bilderberg conferences to neuter democracy in the NATO countries instead of starting a potential nuclear war with them. Tampon Charlie should be thanking the Russians for defeating Hitler. Britain lost 350,000, including my uncle, or the uncle I never knew, obviously, and the Soviets lost 25 million. 70 times more Iranian than we did. Iranian and Russian news is censored in the UK by the telecoms cartel and Ofcom. We have been cancelled off Bilderberg, Ofcom, by the way. They go to the Bilderberg conferences from time to time. And us cancelled off Bristol Community M by the Bristol Mafia and from PRSC by the trans lobby. But anyway, we're still here. I think we better start by having a chat with you, Matt. First of all, we were chatting about you behind your back last week, which is a bit naughty, which was talking about you having moved into a caravan.
I was like, am I going to confess? The shame, you know, is this perception of shame, wasn't there? I didn't think that's where I would want to be, that's for sure. And I did find it in a difficult situation suddenly. I have been in doing temporary sublets, you know, since I've moved to Bristol, and doing activism has not had me be focused on what most people would consider normal ways to sustain yourself, getting a 9-to-5 and all the rest of it. It doesn't go very well with activism.
Can I say as well, important point to make, I think, it's quite clear now, and Martin, I'm sure you'll corroborate this, that actually work is no longer a route out of poverty in this country.
No,
you find yourself quite often worse off by going to work than you will on benefits, isn't that right?
Well, that's certainly the case, that many people in work have to claim universal credit because they can't get enough money from work. And, of course, the rents are so ridiculous in a place like Bristol, second highest in the country. So although Bristol's a very successful city compared to places like Middlesbrough, at the end of the day, you've got to pay the rent, which is, you know, much, much higher than in places like Middlesbrough. So being poor in Bristol is actually not an easy number at all.
Also, I mean, I think, you know, maybe it's a little bit like when I was squatting. I remember thinking, oh, God, I'm squatting. It's so shameful. No, actually, once you're there, once you're doing it, you realise, hey, I can actually be myself. I've got the time to be myself. So a lot of this is about how much time you've got and whether, if you're working, you're pursuing something that you actually believe in and you want to do. I remember this is a long time ago when we were on Bristol Community Radio, Matt. We had a survey by one of the employment agencies, and they'd done a survey of all the people, and it was something like 70% of the people on the agency wanted to get out of the job they were in. Yeah. So this is not a happy bunny country. It's actually likely to seed and fuel mental illness. The idea is if you're working for somebody you don't respect, you don't like, doing a job you don't want to do.
Yeah, and there's supposed to be this threat, isn't there, that if you cannot do a 9-to-5, you will face homelessness and starvation. Interestingly, what I've found some peace from this, because I've realised that you can survive on nothing, actually. A friend who hooked me up with this caravan for free, and it's in decent nick, and it didn't have power or anything, but I can sleep there. I got to the point where I was just like, look, I just want a coffin to sleep in, you know, just give me a coffin, I'll sleep in that. But I wake up smiling most mornings because I just smile at the thought that I'm not paying exorbitant amounts of rent and basically throwing money into the sky because you're paying most of your wages on rent now, and it's not, you don't get to own that property, that's just going into a hole in the sky. So
You might say it's pouring. Maybe it's because you're from New Zealand, but I would say pouring it down the drain.
Pouring it down the drain. But I say up, I suppose, because it's going up to someone better than you.
Oh, yes.
A landlord.
See,
But, you know,
the funny
landlord.
Thing is, quite a lot of buy-to-let landlords, even they are hardly able to make, because there's all sorts of new taxes imposed by the Sunak government on buy-to-let landlords. They've been finding it quite difficult to make money, so therefore they've been having to jack up the prices. So you do wonder where all this money, Martin, where is it all going?
Well, it was chucked at the banks in 2008, and of course there's all the waste of having a base in Akrotiri. I mean, so that we can stick off England to Middle Eastern politics.
But
and
some
therefore,
of it's going,
therefore we can't afford
some
housing.
Some of it's going to the health service as well, though, isn't it?
Well,
you're
yes.
being a bit negative.
That's true, but at the same time, when people say, where's all the money gone? The fundamental answer is the 2008 crash. Because, of course, it wasn't a crash. They were bailed out, and they were still bailed. I mean, what should have happened there is senior people should have been sent to prison and bankrupted and all their assets seized. That's not what happened, is it?
Mm-hmm. And I think that was a trick question, wasn't it, about all some of the money's going to health?
No.
Well, Starmer's cutting that, isn't he? He's cutting disability benefits. He's got NATO war machines to fund, doesn't he?
He does. And also the other fundamental problem that people need to realise is in developed countries, all developed countries are spending more on health as time goes on. A, because people used to live longer. That stopped happening because of austerity. But B, they develop new things that they can do, which cost more money. And in actual fact, if you're going to have a super duper modern economy, why shouldn't you have the best healthcare? And that's what costs. It costs. There's going to be massive. As we go forward, there's going to be more. As we get older and we're quite elderly, there'll be more money needed to be spent on health. And that's not, you can't just keep it the same. And that's an issue which is very difficult for any government to resolve unless they're prepared to bite the bullet.
Well, they're going the other way, though, aren't they? I mean,
yes,
you're cutting.
They are.
Yeah, it's horrendous.
I don't know if you are entitled, any of us are entitled to winter fuel allowance, Martin. Are you? Yeah, you're probably the oldest of us.
Well, not. Yeah,
but,
well.
But anyway, sorry, no, you're not getting that winter fuel.
Well, no, because I'm not a pensioner yet.
Now, according to many commentators reading the BBC, there was actually a very good BBC thread on last week's local elections and the Metro Mayor elections and the by election. They're saying one of the things that constantly was coming up on the doorsteps was the cost of living crisis, the winter fuel allowance. So they're trying to make much of the running about all sorts of issues, but these are the things that the voters are interested in. Doesn't seem to me there's all that much difference really between the Labour Party and the Conservative Party, which may be why Reform has been doing quite well.
Well, what they're saying is, what Farage has been saying is, we would have paid the money to the pensioners, but we're also going to reduce taxes on people like me. And, of course, he's not like Rachel Reeves with the IMF breathing down his neck, is he?
What about modern monetary theory and this idea that actually we could be printing money and spending it on the poor, actually the poor people that need it, and they could spend it and help the economy get moving? This is a sort of Roosevelt New Deal sort of thing at the beginning of, or before Second World War.
Well, it's based modern monetary theory is a revamped version of Keynesianism. But the thing that makes it different from Keynesianism is it's got this idea that the creation of money can be carried out by the government. What we have done for many, many decades, hundreds of years, is we've subcontracted that to private bankers. Now, if your modern monetary theory is going to work, you've got to nationalise the banking system and get rid of private banking if you're really going to do it. Keynesianism was a halfway house, whereby you can borrow them. What you do is you borrow the money off wealthy people and then spend it because they don't want to spend it. But if you modern monetary theory goes a step further and says, well, let's just print the money ourselves and we don't have to borrow it from the wealthy in order to spend it.
What do you make of the rise of Reform? If we project the last week's election result, Matt, you're going to get a Reform government. I think there was going to be something like 30 Conservative MPs. It's basically the end of a 200-year-old party.
Yeah, it's amazing. We're seeing Labour and the Conservatives at like pretty historic lows. I think the door is open for a genuine left to come in, and it's just tumbleweeds at the minute, isn't it? and Nigel Farage is gladly striding in. And yeah,
he's picking up the Labour votes, though, isn't he? He's picking up loads of Labour votes.
Oh yeah.
But anyway,
and they will continue. I think they'll win unless we get a decent left party.
Point the finger at the reformers and say how terrible they are, because they don't even seem to have any social policy. It's mainly just immigration, immigration, immigration. But let's have a listen to.
They've got a couple of good policies too.
Go on, then. Go on.
I have to say. So one is a key one. For me, one of the top three ways to get the UK back to a decent state, just get it to a decent state, is to get off first past the post elections and to move to another form of proportionate representation, which most Western countries have.
I know, but once if they get themselves a majority, they might change their mind about that, won't they? Because that will keep out the smaller parties.
Yeah, but he's campaigned. That's one of their promises. So, I think
you
that's something
them?
To. I think when you make a substantial promise like that. There's just you kill yourself if you one of those key
a substantial promise that Keir Starmer made is that he would freeze fuel prices. I mean, I've just paid another electricity gas bill, absolutely astronomical. It's just going through the roof. And if you don't pay it on time, they also add another 25, 50 quid onto it. They try and make you pay through direct debit, which I just can't do because I don't have the money in my account at the right time to pay it. I have to pay by check when I've got the money. And, this is a bit of a joke, the way they've done all this. So anyway, let's have a listen to one of these wonderful reform UK people called Anne Widdecombe.
A very quiet, very British revolution. And we've now got the message across, which I think was the one that was important and which had always been difficult to get across, which is, look, if you vote reform, you won't get the party that you don't want, either Labour or Tory. You will get reform. You really can vote reform and get reform. And that is a crucial message. I know it's 4 years away still, but it's a crucial message for the next general election.
Yeah.
We really can run Britain. Not only that, but we have a very clear programme. We're going to cut waste. We're going to install efficiency examinations. We're going to get rid of all the nonsense with paying vast quantities of money to keep people in woke jobs and in diversity, equality and inclusion. We're going to actually do all of those things that we said we would do. Now, yes, it is quite true that we don't have long experience, but, new brooms sometimes sweep very clean.
So that's the reform, not MP, spokesperson, Anne Widdecombe there, former Conservative, right-wing of the Conservative Party. They're cock-a-hoop about this, Martin.
Well, obviously, when your team wins, it's not surprising that people are a bit cheerful. But, of course, what I would also suggest is it's a long game. And, of course, the economic policy they've got just doesn't add up. The Labour Party in power have got to make all
matter.
The songs.
It doesn't matter whether it adds up or not, does it?
Because well, it does if you're Rachel Reeves.
If they can get a majority and form a government, it doesn't matter.
Well, in that case, Nigel Farage famously said after Liz Truss's budget that it was the best budget ever, which led immediately to a crash in the pound and the destruction of the economy.
Well, as we're
seeing with Donald Trump.
As we were discussing.
Are Farage going to crash the economy because they can't make their sums add up?
As we were discussing last
people
week.
People vote for them, they're going to find
as
out.
As we were discussing last week, it's quite simple for the international oligarchy to crash the economy on Liz Truss. So the idea.
No, it wasn't crashed. It wasn't the international oligarchy that crashed Liz Truss. It was the Forex market. Now, if Jeremy Corbyn had won, the oligarchy would try and get rid of him. No, there's competence and there's conflict.
So are you saying that you have that actually there is no political motives in the market where the money flows out of Britain or the foreign exchange markets, as you were just referring to, start selling the pound, then it doesn't. There's no political motive and no political impetus behind
that.
There
can be a political motive. There can be a political motive.
Well, there might well have been to get rid of Liz Truss.
Yes, no. I think no, because it wasn't. It wasn't the the Forex market is run by teenagers and 20-somethings with phones.
All right, so there is no political
motive.
No,
they're just trying to make money.
There's no political motive. No, that's what you're saying. No, I don't agree with you at all.
Well, I totally disagree with you. Liz Truss was incompetent, and so was Kwasi Kwarteng.
I'm not saying she was competent. All I'm saying
that's why the economy went
very,
down the drain when
they were
in power.
It's very easy for international finance and the oligarchy to simply press a button and destroy someone's economy.
That's right. And that's what they call
what they call making the economy scream.
That's right. And they do it. But in this case, it was simply incompetence. Okay? They're two different things, Tony.
I think we've got an interview with someone a bit later on about sort of macroeconomics. And I did ask him about Phil Bevin, his name is, about who's in charge, Britain or America. And he got into some of the economic reasons why he thinks actually Britain is still in charge.
Well,
but anyway,
the city of London is still very much at the heart of the international capital.
Well, he's saying the crown.
Well, the crown fulfills, the city is answerable to the crown, the crown and the city are linked.
The Guild Hall.
Yes, and all of that, yeah.
All those people from, God knows, medieval times. Anyway,
that's right.
Let's have a listen to Nigel. Nigel Triumphant.
43 years ago today, a British submarine sunk the pride of the Argentinian fleet, the Belgrano. Yesterday, a motor torpedo boat, with me at the helm... and all of you on the back, we sunk HMS, the Conservative Party.
Yay!
They're over. They are over. They are finished. They literally have been gutted in these counties. It's a position from which they will never, ever recover. Up north, what we see is that if you vote Conservative, you get Labour. You get Labour, because we clearly are now the second place party. We clearly are the challengers to the government. So that's something that we'll be pushing over the course of the next couple of years. The really important thing about what you've done is that if you vote Reform, you get
Reform!
And that's the message. So about half an hour ago, John Curtis on the BBC has put out his projection of what these elections would mean had a general election taken place across the whole of the UK. The figures are remarkable. They show us in a general election on 30%. They show the Labour Party on 20%. The Liberal Democrats on 17%. And the Conservatives on 15%. That would mean the Conservatives would only win 12 seats. And we would have a massive majority. So I don't want to hear any more about deals with the Conservative Party. I would only ever do a deal with you, sir, if I shook your hand, looked you in the eye, and trusted you. They betrayed that trust over the course of 14 years. We are going to chart our own course. So I think, really, this is a truly historic day. We are witnessing the death of a party that's been around for almost 200 years. They will not, they cannot recover from that position. And I honestly believe we've cleared this hurdle. Next year we'll go for the Welsh and Scottish parliamentary elections. Yes. And I believe, and I think you believe, that we can and we will win that next general election.
Yes.
So that's Nigel Farage's speak last week. The closing of the results of the local elections, 12 Tory MPs, by far the largest slice of the votes, 30%, as against the Lib Dems and Labour, around about 20, Martin. I mean, if the Lib Dem, Labour and Tory all gang together, they might be able to get a majority, mightn't they, against Nigel?
Well, that's right. If there was a proportional system, that's what would happen. But because it's a first-past-the-post system, it's undoubtedly the case that we will play on the first-past-the-post.
Yeah. Well, if
then
they
in
can
actual
agree,
fact,
yeah.
we're going, 30% might get you enough to perform a government, or it might not. In which case, you've missed the kick.
They pretty much are a uni party already. It would just be nice for them to solidify that.
Well,
and just
yeah, but it's
well,
they
have in Ireland, they've done that. You know, the Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael have ganged up against Sinn Féin.
Anyway,
the question I want to ask you, Matt, is that can anyone... I mean, Nigel Farage has done an amazing job on the right. Can anyone do this on the left?
Yeah, that's the
question.
I mean,
I know you've been along to these various... I spoke to you a few weeks ago about something up in London that was attempting to unite the left now, and someone standing up and making some joke about the People's Republic the People's Front of Judea versus the Judean People's Front. And it is a bit like that, isn't it? So any possibility, do you think?
Gosh, I mean, I seriously hope so. I personally think that that is the way to victory, to do what the right does very well, to find a popular figure, stick them out the front, and just go all in. This is us. This is what we're doing. Get on board. What I'm hearing is that it's, yeah, a typically more sort of very hierarchy-averse type, you know, type of a, oh, no one wants to, which is obviously admirable in a sense, but it just also doesn't serve in certain situations.
It doesn't work when people criticise people who are very closely allied to them, not quite the same, rather than their political opposites. What is going on in the left? Why have they always been doing this, Martin? Well, they never seem to be able to get their act together.
It's partly to do with culture. I mean, left-wing people are, you know...
Nothing to do with being sort of pig-headed, then.
Well, the pig-headed could be part of the culture, if you like, but the point is you've got what it's like herding cats. The Conservative Party basically was the party of the pocketbook. So everybody wealthy voted Conservative. They didn't care who it was. They didn't even have internal elections. It used to be decided by the party hierarchy. They would prod whoever it was forward, and their donkey vote would go and vote for them because, you know, we all know that we want to keep our wealth. And it's a great big fund, basically. Now, that's broken down, obviously, because of what's happened. On the left, you've got people who, you know, they've all got their own ideas, inevitably. Now, that can be worked. We did put somebody who was quite popular up front called Jeremy Corbyn.
That's right.
Yeah, but of course, he wouldn't accept. I tried to put it to him when mm-hmm. he was trying to be leader of the Labour Party before he'd been elected. I put it to him in round the corner in the Malcolm X Centre. I said, will you commit to proportional representation?
And is that why he didn't mm-hmm. win?
If he'd committed to proportional representation, then all...
He would still not have won, would he?
Can I finish? All Greens and Liberals could vote for him on once to change the system. And that's exactly how the Labour Party brought in proportional representation in New Zealand.
He never got close to the possibility of even doing
that. If he'd said that at the beginning, he'd have been able to pull all those votes in, Tony. That's the point I'm making. It's what the Labour Party did in New Zealand.
It's nothing to do with it. The main reason that Corbyn didn't get in was because he was a very bad leader and he treated his friends worse than his enemies, and he was sucking up to the right-wing pro-Israel lobby within the Labour Party. Also, he did a complete fudge on Brexit too, saying, oh, I think we're going to have another referendum. You know, these are the sorts of things which meant that he wasn't ever going to be leader. I mean, he was attacked from within his own party.
I think that's the real story. He was attacked from within by his own party, and because, not because he sucked up to Zionists, but because he was supporting Palestine, and they called him an anti-Semite, you know, for doing that. And we know what that means now, when someone accuses you, generally, now, in today's climate. It means you're pro not bombing babies in tents. And so I think if he ran again, you know, because I'm sure he's got a hurdle. He's had this and he's been stabbed in the back, and he sort of thinks, why would I do this again? But I just think the context has changed. The key ways that they stopped him, that's changed. You know, they can't use the anti-Semite label on him anymore. It won't have the same sticking power at all. And in fact, it'll probably point out that what he's doing is right about Palestine. And the other thing is that the establishment media no longer has a stranglehold. Independent or social media is now just as much, if not more so, the dominant form and news sources for people. So, you know, there are independent voices, thankfully, that are credible and people are discovering. And I think if Jeremy Corbyn put his name out in front and just went against his own normal natural instincts to sort of sit back and be humble.
The guy groaned because he had his chance and he made a mess of it.
Well, he's a member of... He's an independent member of Parliament.
His party, I think you were...
He's not a member of the Labour Party anymore. He's been booted out.
His party stabbed him in the back.
So, is he going to be the leader of a new, wonderful party?
I mean, well, that would be fantastic. That's how we'd win, I say.
The way that the Labour Party got turned into a pro-Israeli party, where if you started supporting Palestinians, first of all, you were never going to be able to stand as a candidate, even as a local councillor. And secondly, you might actually be ejected from the party, Martin.
Yes, but what we've got, in fact, when people are going on about reform, they've got five MPs. The independents, led by Jeremy Corbyn and the four independents that were elected, mostly Muslims from different parts of the country, they've got as many MPs as reform, under first past the post. and reform, if they aren't going to commit to proportional representation, that's still in their manifesto, I suppose.
Yeah.
But I mean, they will also find that if the right-wing vote is split and the Conservative Party even gets just 10% of the vote, that'll be enough to keep them out. And then they'll have to have another go in 8 years' time. And then, but by then, of course, all sorts of things can happen. This is a very, very volatile situation in the global economy. It's not. We might not even get to a next election.
It always seems to me so sad to see Jeremy Corbyn in the House of Commons, and he's just an independent MP. He's got a party of one.
Well, he's working with the four other independents.
They are independents. They're all independent parties of one. They're not really a party. And so it's like he's lost everything, but he managed to just about cling on to his seat, you know. And he's not only lost the country, he's lost the ability...
The ability to
support the Palestinians and to stop arms supplies to Israel, this sort of thing, which has become the most important issue on planet Earth, it seems to me, at the moment.
He's still fighting on it. You know, they're still... The independent MPs are still making good representations and letters and pushbacks and all
that. Well, that's true. Actually, that's our next item, because we've got over 40 Labour MPs have written a letter to Keir Starmer about the right-wing capitalist corporate oligarch social policies of Keir Starmer, the so-called Labour leader. So let's have a listen to a report on that. I think it's actually our local MP, Darren... Jones, is it Darren? Yeah, Darren Jones, Chief Secretary to the Treasury, that gets grilled about this. Do you mind that 40 of your own MPs are saying, why are you forcing kids and people into poverty? You're supposed to be the Labour Party.
More than 40 Labour MPs have now written a letter to protest about the welfare cuts, saying that they are impossible to support the planned cuts to disability benefits. I mean, it's not a great look, is it? Isn't the Prime Minister going to have to listen over this one?
Well, look, it's important that MPs represent their constituents. We are all first and foremost constituency MPs, and that's why, as members of Parliament, irrespective of which party's in government, you'll be part of discussions around changes to policy and legislation. On welfare specifically, our starting principles are the right ones, which is that if people need support, we will make sure they have it. But for people who can and want to get back into work, we're going to put in the mechanisms to help them to do so. The bill in question is not published yet. I'm sure it will be shortly. And in the normal way, the government will work with members of Parliament to reassure them, to listen to them, to look at the drafting of those details as the bill passes through the House.
Okay. Darren Jones, Chief Secretary to the Treasury, thanks for joining us this morning.
So there he is, Labour MP, Bristol, is it North West?
Yeah.
MP. Martin, is he making any sense? He doesn't seem to be saying all that much other than, are you going to listen? He just dodges the question.
Well, as it comes forward, let's imagine that there was a rebellion over this from the back benches of the Labour Party.
It's only 40, isn't it? It's not many.
40 won't be enough, but it'll be interesting to see how Reform vote. Are they going to vote for cutting benefits for disabled people? And I dare say they will either not vote, they'll abstain, or they'll vote in favour of cutting benefits. So this is going to be interesting how this plays out. Mm. Now, of course,
Martin, they're going for the Labour vote. They might just realise, well, it won't make any difference. There's only a few of us, so they can vote for it anyway.
Okay,
how cynical politics is.
Okay, well, let's just talk about the cynical politics of it then. So, let's say 40 Labour MPs vote against. That reduces the government's majority. If 5 extra Reform votes are added to that, and of course you've got also the SNP, Plaid Cymru, the Greens, they'll all vote against it. But what will be interesting is if the Tories vote against it. Yeah? Because now they're not in power, it'll be a stick to beat the government with, let's knock this back. And it'll be very interesting to see where everybody stands on this, including Nigel. Does he want to cut benefits for people? Because if he does, he'd better vote for it. If he doesn't, want to cut it. And then the subsequent question to him is, where's the money going to come from? From taxes on people like you, Nigel? In the top tax bracket? Is that where the money's to come from to pay for these benefits?
Okay, so the universal winter fuel payments and for pensioners, this hasn't actually... Am I right in thinking it hasn't actually kicked in yet? It's going to be next winter that it kicks in.
I don't know, Tony. I can't remember now.
The local elections and the Runcorn by-election, this is a major thing that came up. The Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, was asked about this week. Are you going to reconsider it? And he says no. There's genuine concern in the Labour Party, that right across the party, not just among certain MPs, that the Green Paper proposals on disability and long-term health benefits are wrong and totally flawed. The MP added, anonymous MP, scared to give their name. That's the culture of fear that there is at Westminster. Their remarks follow reports that ministers have already sketched out further benefit cuts for the autumn. Experts in welfare policy are sceptical about how any more savings could actually be found without the government resorting to freezing universal credit. That's quite possible, isn't it? And, of course, if they freeze it, that will mean that inflation starts eating into it and poverty rises.
Well, that's right. They've made a big political pig's ear.
I mean, poverty's rising anyway, so it'll rise faster.
Yes, they've made a political pig's ear of all of this, obviously. I think it's...
No, it's not a pig's ear. This is their policy. There's a World Economic Forum, capitalist oligarch policy that's being implemented by the Labour Party.
What they're doing is they're following the neoliberal playbook, which is we've got to balance the books. Now, what they could have said, we're not going to balance the books... But they didn't say that. They said, we're going to balance the books over a, you know, whatever period it is, so that the wealthy won't get frightened. Yeah? The Labour Party has always got to be absolutely squeaky, squeaky clean about balancing books. Meanwhile, of course, in the US, both parties, Democrats and Republicans, they never balance the books and nobody cares. They go on about it all the time, but nobody does because they've got the world's reserve currency. The pound is no longer the world's reserve currency. Now, there are ways to resolve all of this, but Rachel Reeves made all the wrong calls, in my view. But, of course, Starmer and Reeves are bound together now, so he's got to support her, whether he likes it or not, because otherwise it's going to start a fight with her. She, basically, is lacks imagination. That's what I'd say about Rachel Reeves. It's not that she lacks competence, like Liz Truss.
So how on earth did she graduate from being the lady that runs the customer call centre at the Royal Bank of Scotland to Chancellor? Did she do a quick course or, a fast speed learning in the world economy?
She worked for the Bank of England. And
And what was she doing there?
As you say, she wasn't doing what she claimed to be doing, but she's somebody like Liz Truss has never managed a whelk stall. She did PPE at Oxford like I did, but she's an ignoramus.
Did she have any sort of relationship with the Governor of the Bank of England?
I don't know, Tony. Reeves is that she's the person in the job at the moment, and you don't... I mean, John McDonald's ended up as the Chancellor, he's got no background in finance. You don't have to have a background in finance to be a Chancellor of the Exchequer. You need to know the basic stuff, and you need to have advisors who will tell you what you need to do to get what you want done.
Now, those advisors, who will be paying them?
Well, this is a question.
And who will be making? Will they be advisors from these big private banks?
Well, the point is, the Labour Party is now funded by wealthy people. It used to be funded by the trade unions. Reform is funded by lots of wealthy people. Where do they get their money from? And of course, they're attracting quite a lot of money now. And what we need to see is Nigel come out and say,
"The smart money is on reform." That's
the smart
what I've
money
heard.
Is on reform, and then Nigel's got to come out and say, "The only way we can balance the books is by raising taxes on wealthy people." And many of the reform voters will go, "Yeah, but is that what the reform funders want?" The answer is, "Nah."
Yeah. Now, on the topic of funding, because obviously a party that's going to succeed does in this world need funding. Matt Cunard, he did a good event, Wealth In at Warfare, here in Bristol last week, and he said
declassified.
Started declassified. He's now moved from them, and he's sort of roving around independently. But he does great work. I hope everyone out there knows his work and follows him. I think he does the best investigative stuff in the UK at the minute.
You mean as good as us?
Yeah, Prison Company, not excluded.
Gets paid for it.
He's uncovering like the spy flights flying over Gaza that the UK is doing daily and still has not been reported at all in any establishment media outlet. As well as some, what do you call them, Secret Service soldiers from the UK over there.
His is called Deep Sight News now.
Oh, is that
Drop Site News.
Is that actually his platform?
I don't know. It looks like it.
He certainly published on them this week. But he's also worked with Double Down News and various others. So, but what his great strategy was suggesting was that, you know, to fund a new party, that the unions must divest from Labour, which, of course, was, you know, originally started to represent the unions and the workers. And now they are absolutely not. So why on earth would the unions continue to fund Labour? They are not a viable alternative to the Conservatives anymore. For my money, they are worse than the Conservatives. They're more Tory than Tory. I feel the same about the Democrats in the US. They're now more dangerous than the, we can get onto that too, than the Republicans under Trump. But, yeah, I think that's a great strategy for us to focus on, putting pressure, well, you know, imploring our unions to actually make a smart choice and find something else to a new party, but at the very least, like, divest from Labour and let's find a way to support, yeah. And I think the strategy at the minute is, well, he also, Matt Kinnard also hinted at that meeting. He almost said something and then he backtracked and said, oh, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say that. He said, he suggested something was coming. And then someone asked a question, is there going to be a new left party? What's happening? And he started into saying something and then he said, oh, I don't think I can say that. And he was referring to a conversation he had with JC, Jeremy Corbyn, at the last Welfare Not Warfare that I was at in London as well. I saw them talking, in fact. I had a chat to them both. But that's interesting. The strategy that
MI5 will be interested in that, I'm sure.
But the strategy that they have been talking about is that they're looking for independents in different constituents that can lead, that are genuinely popular, you know, genuine local leaders. So I think that is a good strategy in lieu of having anything in the meantime. And the strategy may be that once we have these independents, that a party could form. And maybe that's happening in the background.
Well, there seems to be a lot of talking and not a lot. It's almost like the Reform and the Right are the opposite. They don't talk much; they just do things. And they also organise regional get-togethers. So there's all sorts of places. If you're a member of Reform, come and meet some of the leaders face to face. Cut out the mainstream media in between. And it seems to me the left has got to follow some sort of strategy like that. But it's ever so difficult getting a degree on anything. It might partly be because they're so infiltrated by the MI, you know, Socialist Workers Party.
It'd be nice to be able to always blame the MI5 or CIA. Well,
they do infiltrate it.
But unfortunately, sometimes it's just incompetence. I found that on campaigning, it's just like people are real quick to accuse you of being an agent sabotaging. Yeah. It's like, no, you can often put that down just to a bit of incompetence.
Ego. Ego. Anyway, look, on the Tory party side, don't worry, the Tory party's not over, Martin. I can see you wiping the tears from your eyes about the end of the Tory party because Boris is back.
You cannot, in politics, you can't hope to make yourself more compelling or attractive or dynamic or successful by having some sort of transplant operation. I mean, or merger or monkey glands infusion from another party. It doesn't work. Right. It doesn't work. And what I always used to say, and remember that Reform was on zero when I was around, right? Mm. Zero.
Do you think was Farage leading it then?
I can't remember. I think he was actually. I don't know. Anyway, but you know, the golden rule of life is of politics is you're there to serve the voters, and you're there to think about what they want you to do. So you've got to be talking about them, about us, about our country, about the way forward, and if possible, not talking about your own political difficulties and your opponents and everything else. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That's, keep off that. Tories are going to recover. Tories are definitely going to recover. Of course they will. Because I think in the end, the people of this country are going to be completely fed up by 2028, 9, whatever it is, with a high tax, high regulation, massively woke government that is taking us in completely the wrong direction. And so the goal is really wide open.
So you don't think we'll see Prime Minister Farage?
I don't, no. And I think that if you look at the direction of travel of the country at the moment, the case for conservatism is really overwhelming. I travel around quite a lot. And that's how I've flown in, especially to see you.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah.
Quite right. But there's so many Brits around the world. Always have been. There are more Brits per head, I think. We have a bigger international diaspora than virtually any other OECD country, but certainly per capita, but it's colossal. But Dubai is now the 19th biggest British city in the world, right? It's bigger than Wolverhampton, far bigger. And it's because Dubai's smaller than Wolverhampton, but it's got more Brits than what I think. It's wonderful that for Dubai, I guess, but it's also a bit sad for why are so many people leaving? I was a kid in the 1970s. You were, before most of our viewers were born. I remember the tyranny, the terror of the Labour government in the 1970s and the tax rates and people literally fleeing. And it's under Starmer, it's happening again. It's absolutely unbelievable. Mm. And I think my point is by 2029, people will have had enough of that. They'll want a new approach. I think they'll want to go back to the Conservatives, definitely.
Well, he seems very sure of himself. Quite an amusing turn of phrase, which is why he was so popular as a leader, which is why it was sort of suicidal, really, for the Conservatives to get rid of him and bring in Sunak, who was megally unpopular as his own approval rating. But what do you make of this guy, Matt? I'm thinking about returning to politics. I love Kerry Badenoch, but I think she's just needs a little bit of steering in the right direction.
Oh gosh, I mean, I don't hold much hope for him. He does have all I can say is he has my favourite UK political quote of all time, when he said to a group meeting, he said, "None of you have any questions for me. You're not going to challenge me, you great supine protoplasmic invertebrate jellies." I just thought, off the top of his head, that was pretty good. And he was almost riffing back on that as he's talking about monkey gland transplants. I was like, if he keeps that up, man, I might follow him, but I'm not going to vote for him. I mean, he didn't have a cogent argument as to why reform weren't going to win, I think he's not facing reality there.
Well, yeah, I mean, he likes attention. He's an attention-seeking person.
Yeah.
And, he's out of the limelight now, but he keeps pushing himself back in there.
It's a bit annoying when he's going on about people going off to Dubai, when actually, of course, it's his government that's created the economic circumstances.
Well, I mean, who gets to go to Dubai anyway?
Well, young graduates who want to earn 10 times more than they can earn here in Britain.
It's not your average reform voter in Runcorn.
She was a lawyer. She did the smart thing. She got a real job, I was, fighting for the rule of law as an activist. But brings me back to Boris, and the main reason I can never vote for him is that he was a journalist at one point, and he said nothing about Julian Assange, and he was Prime Minister while Julian Assange rotted away in Belmarsh Dungeon.
I think the only thing I can remember him mentioning Assange was Prime Minister's questions when Starmer was quizzing him. Oh. And he said, "Oh yeah, you're the one that's been locking up, you're the one who was locking up journalists, and failed to lock up Jimmy Savile when you were head of the Crown Prosecution Service."
You're kidding? Did he actually say
that? I think so.
Starmer.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Okay,
this
is breaking news. I'm going to vote for Boris.
This is about 5 years
that's
ago.
That's all
say
it takes.
That.
He's not even standing for anything at the moment.
Any politician.
He got absolutely
really
hammered.
Boris
got hammered for that. He got hammered for that, but which was a great pity because, of course, it's true. Starmer did take. In fact, he destroy all the papers as well.
Yeah,
for Julian's when Julian was he was Starmer
right.
himself was going backwards and forwards to Sweden. How can we stitch
and
this
he was going
kid
to
up?
Washington, actually, more crucially,
and Washington. Yeah,
yeah.
Right. So
pretending it was about a Swedish extradition,
and then he burnt the evidence.
Flying.
I mean, he is the chief of Crown prosecutions. He should be prosecuted himself and put in jail.
Well, that's right. That brings us now. But all of that's true. He was the head of the Crown prosecution persecution of Assange. He's one of the chief architects. And one of these great letters from one of the independent MPs.
We're on Starmer now, not Boris.
Yeah, Starmer. So, you know, as I was saying earlier, some of these independents are challenging Starmer, thankfully, on the whole fact that the UK is not just complicit, but actively involved in a genocide. I loved this letter because a lot of Israeli statements, I mean, they have been all along, but it's becoming even more clear as time goes on. They're saying exactly what they're doing and doing it. And so this letter to Keir Starmer from Shoka Adam MP points, the Israeli government has approved a plan to officially conquer Gaza. Minister Smotrich has vowed that Gaza will be, quote, entirely destroyed and that Palestinians will have to, quote, leave in great numbers to third countries. And then he finishes this letter to Starmer saying, will the Prime Minister now finally acknowledge the ethnic cleansing is underway and end all UK military cooperation with Israel, especially the illegal provision of F-35 fighter jet parts, and be the Prime Minister to see Britain answer at The Hague for its role in this atrocity? I love that little bit at the end. And will he be the Prime Minister to see Britain answer at The Hague? It's very... It's like, yeah, he belongs in The Hague. Like, that he needs to answer to The Hague.
Yeah, if The Hague can do its job properly.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah,
if there's any justice.
Let's have a listen to Julian now. I know you're a bit of a fan.
Right.
And
right.
This is when he was just out of jail. He was talking about, since we're talking now a little bit about Gaza and about the horrors down there, where he's talking about the idea of artificial intelligence being used for mass assassination.
I emerge from prison. I see that artificial intelligence... is being used to create mass assassinations, where before there was a difference between assassination and warfare. Now the two are conjoined, where many, perhaps the majority of targets in Gaza, are bombed as a result of artificial intelligence targeting. The connection between artificial intelligence and surveillance is important. Artificial intelligence needs information to come up with targets or ideas or propaganda. When we're talking about the use of artificial intelligence to conduct mass assassinations, surveillance data from telephones, internet, is key to training those algorithms.
Yeah, this was a great point of Julian. He's made that point before in his writing, and when I stumbled across it, it's a thought that had occurred to me. I often do this. I don't read always very widely, and then I find someone that's written this thought that I've come up with, but maybe 5,000 years ago. I probably should read more widely. This quote that he's talking about, that he made this quote that it doesn't really matter that we're under mass surveillance because they're not actually smart enough to figure out what to do with all this information.
Ooh, he said I don't believe that.
Yeah, but this was my thought. But I was like, he said that when it really becomes dangerous is when they have AI, which has the power to sort through all of this masses, because they're drowning in information. Like, they, you know, but the AI can sort through it all in the flash of an eye and actually present some, and if you ask it the right questions, it can give you, well, how can I completely control this population? And I don't think people quite realize the massive shift and the danger and the opportunity. It's not all doom, but there is a massive shift in all respects underway. The threats, you know, they've got robots, you know, they're already working in police forces around the world that have authority to use lethal force, even in New York. And they've got the Daddy's Home Palantir technology, the AI that he's talking about there. And if any listeners out there recognize Palantir, they made this Daddy's Home AI that will control a drone and follow a suspected Hamas fighter home, all the way home, and wait till he gets home at dinner time and is with their family to blow up the home and kill the family, which is so dreadful and cynical. The company that's created that...
It's all okay, let's just use the word evil, please.
Yeah, go on. They also own all our private health data. They now own our NHS data.
Hang on, I thought I opted out of that.
Did you? Yeah, no.
Well, I don't know. Well, I probably didn't. Well, look, the point to make here is go back to 1935. Yeah. In Germany, the Nazis had come to power. They had a census. Actually, the Nazis had, what they'd done is they'd sorted the economy out a bit so that people had jobs. It wasn't, they weren't starving anymore. People were starting to say, ah, these guys are doing quite a good job. Mm. And as you're filling in your census form and you put Jewish on the census form, you might have hesitated a little bit. Mm. But that data, most people had no idea how that data was going to be used. What we've got now is absolutely massive amounts of data, far more than the Nazis had in the 1930s.
Oh, absolutely. I mean,
so
they can,
should another authoritarian system be implemented right then, all this AI searching through all this data is simply going to either drone you or else you know, maybe they'll send some to the police to come and arrest you or whatever. But we're going towards almost like a kind of a techno nightmare version of Nazi Germany.
Oh, absolutely. Techno tyranny. My only question, I mean, I also see the positive opportunity for technology. Like Julian used WikiLeaks, he used technology for good. You know, you can use it for good or you can use it for evil.
If only the mass media would have amplified the good that he was doing. You know, they just do the opposite. They buried it.
That's right. Well, they jumped in for a while. He did it. That was one of the amazing things he did. He did get them to come together and work on those releases, but then they turned their back once the hit the fan. But, you know, we can use AI. I mean, I use AI to filter through stuff and find information. You've got to challenge it. You cannot take it at its word.
We had an AI report on the show last week, which is two AIs chatting to each other. I really don't want to do that very often.
No, you got to challenge.
But it was quite good. You know, they did actually a reasonably good job. Looking actually, and the idea, of course, with last week's report was looking at Curtis Yarvin and my old school friend Nazi Nick Land, and the AI did quite a good job. The idea is that we're using them to so we can understand what are they up to. So the idea is to try to turn around the AI, turn the technology around, and use it against the people who want to weaponize computers against humanity.
Absolutely, and that was WikiLeaks. Strategies. They looked at a lot of the ways that corrupt power was succeeding to uphold power, and they turned it against it. They took inspiration from Swedish banks, you know, hiding wealth, and they were like, "Oh, we could hide data and have leaks that were protected." And you know, so the WikiLeaks model of making whistleblowers safe.
Yeah, but you talk about health information. Now, this is really dodgy, isn't it? Because this is potentially very valuable. Insurance companies will pay for, oh, right, okay, so they've got that bit of health problem. That means we won't give them any health insurance and they will die. This sort of thing is... Yeah. This is not being regulated, what it seems, at all by governments. The governments are sort of twiddling their thumbs with either bad ideas or ideas that are totally ineffective and just public relations. But on the UK column... I mean, I'm not a great fan of UK column, but they do some brilliant stuff. I mean, the reason I don't really like them is they're kind of po-faced, but also because a lot of the stuff they do is sort of in a little box, which I don't know. They don't spread their wings much, and they're not prepared to entertain a lot of the theories out there. That, I mean, it's totally up to them. I believe in a free press, but I'm not. I mean, I think they're basically controlled opposition. Like, for example, they had some brilliant speeches by Alex Thompson, by Catherine Gunn a few weeks ago in Cheltenham at a conference. Nope, can't see them anywhere. So it's only for the paying people who were there on the day that get to see the speeches. Now, I cannot understand why is that speech sitting there on a hard drive? They've made their money from doing that event, and why can't they just put it up online a few weeks afterwards? But they don't for some reason. So that's my little dig at UK column. But they do brilliant stuff, and here's one. This is Vanessa Beely on there talking about exactly what we were just saying, which is Israeli. Well, actually, no, that Palantir's American, I think.
They're American, but they are working with the IDF to make this AI drone.
Mike Robinson and Vanessa Beely talking about Israeli tech firms from this thing called... Actually, maybe, Martin, you can say something about Unit 8200. Apparently, this is an Israeli military arm of the Israeli military, a bit like GCHQ or the National Security Agency. But once the military people serving in this unit, Signals Intelligence Unit, Computer Cyber Hacking Unit, have finished their term of a couple of years in there, then they go out and start businesses and they go all over the world.
Yeah, you'll find that the big tech, Silicon Valley tech companies have got loads and loads of ex-Israeli intelligence officers in virtually every department. So the one of the strategies of the Israeli state has been to take over what you might call military technology, you know, IT.
I think there was a bit of a hoo-ha because here in Kingswood in Bristol, our gay MP, Labour MP for Kingswood, is married to some
guy from 8 he was previously a spy for 8200.
Yeah, so maybe he still is a spy for.
Well, you don't resign from these kind of things, do you?
It's like the Hotel California, man. Anyway, look, so let's have a listen to Vanessa Beely and Mike Robinson on UK Column talking about the extent to which Israeli tech firms have infiltrated the British government and the health service.
Another Unit 8200 spawned company is this one. This is the NSO Group. NSO creates technology that helps government agencies prevent and investigate terrorism and crime to save thousands of lives around the globe. Well, that sounds wonderful. But of course, they don't just work with governments, as we'll come on to in a second. Now, in June 2023, Vanessa reported on this program that NSO Group's Pegasus software had been used to hack the phones of journalists in France, including a senior member of staff at France 24. And the fact that that hack had happened was made public by a French non-profit media organization called Forbidden Stories, who were working with Amnesty International, and they had obtained a list of 50,000 telephone numbers that had been compromised by clients of NSO Group who had bought access to the Pegasus software. Now, the hack itself worked by exploiting a vulnerability in WhatsApp, which meant that the spyware could be installed on the target phone by simply making a phone call to that phone. The phone call didn't even need to be answered by the person who was being attacked by this. Now, yesterday, then, a jury in US court has decided that enough is enough, and they have fined NSO Group $167 million in punitive damages. The jury also awarded WhatsApp $444 million in compensation, which is, in a sense, pretty disgusting, since all of that money will go to Meta, and not will go to the people who receiving are on the receiving end of the hacks. Now, WhatsApp said today's verdict in WhatsApp's case is an important step forward for privacy and security as the first victory against the development and use of illegal spyware and that threatens the safety and privacy of everyone. Today's jury decision forces NSO, a notorious foreign spyware merchant, to pay damages as a critical deterrent to this malicious industry against their illegal acts aimed at American companies and the privacy and security of the people we serve. So it's quite interesting that they don't mention Israel directly in that press release. They just call them as a foreign spyware company.
Who are our government working for and whose national security are they protecting? It becomes clear that they're not protecting British citizens. National security, because they're allowing what is now a state conducting a genocide and has been for 100 years to store our DNA, to collect data on us, to surveil us, to collaborate on projects within the national health sector in the UK and in the EU and in the US. So to what degree are we looking at state capture here? And why has our government, not only the current one, but preceding ones, why have they allowed such state capture to such an extent? This is what people should be extremely worried about, because I would guarantee it would be interesting to do a survey on how many 8200 companies are now involved in UK sectors across the country.
Well, that's a good question, Vanessa. How many? It seems to me, Martin, that this has been a deliberate thing, basically. I mean, they talk about the five eyes, don't they? But we know it's really six eyes. I mean, it should be 10 eyes if these are human beings, unless they're like robots with one eye in the middle of their forehead. But with Mossad and the Israelis, as well as the British, the Americans, the Canadians, the Australians and the New Zealanders, the five eyes, the six eyes, this surely is what they're doing, is that they're actually integrating their old mates in this intelligence network into the militaries of these various different countries and also into their government, their civil service.
Well, that's right. I mean, the Israelis are like a Trojan horse within all of this, but of course they've been let in. You know, it's not as if they've been deliberately kept out. If we had our own equivalent of 8200, which I suppose would be Brigade 77, you know, the British Army's cyber warfare people. They should be protecting us. So Prime Minister Corbyn should be able to rely upon Brigade 77 to deal with Israeli attempts to subvert government policy. But that's not what's going on, is it?
It's more GCHQ, really. Anyway, Matt.
Yeah, well, it comes back to, you know, trying to also bring some hope in. While I think it's really important to paint the negative picture of possibility where we could be going very quickly, and the positive, because it's just a time of transformation, and we have to seize the means, you know, seize the technology. And as I say, Julian was very good at that, and he... someone criticized WikiLeaks for being... It was Mike Pompeo, an intelligence... hostile non-state intelligence service.
Oh, that's right, yeah. Yeah, like us. That's what we are, folks. Yeah, hostile non-state intelligence.
That's right.
But exactly, we're hostile to genocide.
Yeah. No, that's exactly what Yanis Varoufakis said. Yes, we are a hostile... Well, he didn't say hostile. We are a non-state intelligence service. That's what WikiLeaks is. So that's an example of using emerging technology to the advantage of the people. And on that as well, Julian also made this great point. I believe it was in his Cypherpunks book, which he wrote quite early on, before he came to fame. And he talked about how encryption takes more energy to decrypt information than it does to encrypt it. So he talked about this because he was a physicist as well as a computer scientist at University of Melbourne. And he talks about this, like, this is really interesting. This means that in the laws of the universe, the physical properties of the universe, privacy is inherent. Like, so what this means and what's hopeful about this is that as long as we embrace, adopt, and create systems that cannot be surveilled, cannot be censored, and that technology absolutely is within our grasp. In fact, it technically may already be up and running. As long as we adopt that and spread it and educate people that they must adopt it, then we can have decentralized, encrypted, uncensorable, private, as long as you want it to be private, communication.
Is this why the energy bills are so high? It's because the state is using all this energy to decrypt our encrypted stuff.
True, but it's.
I remember, listen, you've taken me back to 1996.
Oh, yeah.
Which was something called PGP, Pretty Good Privacy, it was called.
Yeah,
invented
right.
by a guy called Phil Zimmerman.
Yeah.
We used to joke, make silly jokes on it, and send these encrypted chunks by email.
Right.
And I found, it was really bizarre that I found that the emails were being interrupted and one or two characters were being changed in the email as before it got to Fran, to our friend in London.
Oh, yeah.
So this was considered a threat. And I remember Phil Zimmerman writing about it at the time and saying that he'd been taken to court by the US government, saying this is a weapon of war and you cannot cannot have this encrypted PGP, Pretty Good Privacy. It worked extremely well.
Yeah,
I mean,
not even referenced in that.
And then, of course, there's the other thing, which is the platform, software platform. So the operating system, you know, which is obviously CIA, Bill Gates, Windows is the one everyone's supposed to use. Well, there's others around, like Linux.
From the start, yeah.
And there was this famous Halloween memo, which was in the late 1990s, from the Bill Gates, one of his managers. I don't know if it was actually from Gates himself. Saying, look, and it was sent on Halloween, which is why they called it the Halloween memo, that we will have to destroy this because all the people that are contributing towards open source software are doing it for free, and there's potentially tens of thousands of them across the world. We can't compete with this, so we need to kill it now before it starts to take off, the Halloween memo.
Kill which part? The pretty good?
We need to kill off open source operating system that might compete with Windows.
Yeah, no, that's right. And as you say, I was shocked to learn that it's not that the CIA come in and found a successful product. They seed funded. They were biggest initial investors on Microsoft and Apple. So Google began as a CIA project as well. And what's the other big tech company in the States that Trump's in bed with? Another one. But yeah, it makes sense, but you know, why they would want to to do that and why you'd want to control. You're not looking for threats. But the problem with that is that the tool can be much more easily used for tyranny, and if, you know, absolute power corrupts absolutely. So, sorry, you know, we need, what's that great quote by one of those, was it Jefferson, saying that, you know, give me dangerous freedom over you know, safe slavery any day, you know. It's got to be like that. Yeah.
Okay, well, anyway, look, before we get through to and get on to looking at some more international stuff, maybe start with Gaza, move on. Let's have a listen to Dr. John Campbell, who this week has, I think, done an excellent report on this whole idea of dimming the sun. This is a great new sort of wheeze by the government. But the question is, British government, how have they decided to do this? Who is deciding to do this? And it's something, let me tell you, called the Advanced Research and Invention Agency. And if you want to go and have a look at their minutes, you can't. So let's have a listen to Dr. John Campbell talking about this actually earlier on today now.
Welcome to this talk, and it seems appropriate to go out into the sunshine to talk about the sun-dimming experiments that are such a concern at the moment. Now, I've been reading an article from the Daily Telegraph that the secretive government unit planning to dim the sun. We really do need complete open transparency in the way that these decisions are made. And this Telegraph article is calling it a secretive government unit. And more people are now aware of this unit and what they call the government's opaque research arm. If we're paying for it, why don't we have transparency on this? It really is quite confusing. And this, of course, is the Advanced Research and Invention Agency that we've talked about. Apparently, it was set up by Kwasi Kwarteng and Dominic Cummings, thought of the original idea. I can see where they're coming from, this idea that scientists need to be completely free to investigate new things. But this isn't really science to me. This is more technology. Science is about new ideas. This is more about environmental manipulation, which is not, perhaps not what they thought of it would originally be. Few people on the street know what it is, what it does, how well financed it is by us taxpayers, this Advanced Research and Invention Agency. The Telegraph says, sure, it's got a shiny website stocked with techno waffle, promising to help scientists. Help scientists do what? Reach for the edge of the possible and foster opportunity spaces. I'm not sure what an opportunity space is, but reach for the edge of the possible. I mean, this is just rhetoric, isn't it? We need specifics. What is going on here? There's been little clarity on its day-to-day operations. Anyway, this week we've learnt £56.8 million has been allocated, we believe, on 21 climate cooling projects, including looking into the logistics of building a sunscreen in space. Now, less sunlight coming to the Earth, less photosynthesis. Less photosynthesis, more carbon dioxide left in the atmosphere. This just seems completely ridiculous. Surely we want to get carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. Why on earth would we want to reduce photosynthesis? To leave more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere? And to put less oxygen into the atmosphere? It just makes no sense to me at all. And many people have pointed out the ludicrous effect on solar panels as well. Anyway, sunshade in space. No, I don't want that. Thank you very much. And injecting plumes of salt water into the sky to reflect the sunlight away from the Earth. And we've looked at some of the risks in this, and we'll be looking at some more in a minute. Injecting plumes of salt water into the sky to reflect sunlight away from the Earth. Representatives from the Advanced Research and Invention Agency said, rather disingenuously, according to the Telegraph, in a press briefing, we're not trying to dim the sun. Eh? We're not trying to dim the sun? I would have thought that if the experiment is successful, that is exactly the intended outcome. Let's hope they're not trying to be deliberately disingenuous with the public here. Now, Professor Mike Hume, Cambridge University, quoted in the Telegraph, experiments are setting Britain on a slippery slope towards mass deployment of technologies that will be impossible to prove safe, effective and reversible until they're actually in the sky. So warnings from Professor Hume. $57 million is a huge amount of taxpayer money to be spent on this assortment of speculative technologies intending to manipulate the Earth's climate. This is technology, in my view, rather than science. Now, apparently, this group, the Advanced Research and Invention Agency, has been given £800 million budget. Don't know what we've got to show for it so far, but some off-the-wall ideas, according to The Telegraph. Apparently, the chief executive is... The Telegraph names these people. I'm not going to name them. The chief executive is paid £450,000 a year, three times what the Prime Minister's earning. There was something a few years ago that said that public servants aren't supposed to earn more than the Prime Minister, but this chief executive earns about three times that. Chief Finance Officer of Advanced Research and Invention Agency is on £215,000 a year. Chief Product Officer is on £175,000 a year. Overall, 37 staff, that's all that work there, are being paid £4.1 million on wages every year. Essentially, the ARIA is operating like a private company, but doing so on public finances, according to The Telegraph. Then there's a heading, playing poker with public money. In January, it announced it would be giving £69 million to research on, listen to this, neural robots for epilepsy treatment. I don't know what a neural robot is, but apparently £69 million for research on neural robots. Genetic engineering, I've got an inkling into what that is and I don't like it. Genetic engineering of brain cells. This sounds really quite stuff I don't think we should be dabbling in, to be quite honest. Genetic engineering of brain cells. According to The Telegraph, I have no more details than that. And lab-grown brain organoids. Lab-grown brain organoids. I don't know what an organoid is. I know what an organelle is. I know what an organ is. But an organoid, presumably it means part of an organ. Lab-grown brain organoids. This is what our money is being spent on. I don't consent.
Okay, well, I'll tell you who will know what an organoid is. Nick Land. Nick Land will know exactly what an organoid is. I mean, all this sort of word that he might make up. So this is, seems to me, just more kind of techno-weirdness, techno-fascism, accelerationism. But the point about this report from John Campbell, Martin, is what on earth are they thinking about doing by dimming the sun? This is going to mean less photosynthesis and less oxygen, more CO2. I mean, it's just insane. But there they are. They've been funded tens of millions of pounds to go and get on with this, and no one's allowed to know what they're up to. That's the way the British government operates today.
Well, I was astonished that anybody would even suggest such a madcap thing, but not only is it's not some crazy idea, how much money have they been given to fulfil this project?
Well, he just told us, I'm sorry, but, you know, because Adele was just arriving, we didn't get to hear all of it, but the point the listeners heard, tens of millions of pounds is going into this kind of stuff, organoids too, and sun dimming, and none of it is accountable at all. It's a private-public partnership. So it's a publicly controlled private company, this agency.
Well, what it is it's not government controlled, because obviously if it was government controlled, you would have to have some, they'd have to provide some accounts and so on by subcontracting it out to whoever they've subcontracted it out to. They can just get on with it and we're not allowed to know what they're doing. But I mean, it does seem absolutely crazy when we've supposedly got a fiscal squeeze on and we haven't got money for this, that and the other, dentists, potholes in the road, that we've got millions to throw away on a plan to reduce sunlight. And I don't think that would actually get many votes in any election round here. Most Brits want more sunlight, don't they?
Well, no. Actually, what most Brits want is to end the cost of living crisis, to tax the super rich. None of this is actually translating in through elections, which is hence why Reform, as a kind of protest party, are doing so well here. Anyway, Matt, I know you're going to be off in a minute. I just wondered if there's anything else you wanted to add, particularly this sort of use of technology. Genetic engineering being paid for by British taxpayers, and yet we can't afford to keep our elderly people warm in the winter.
Yeah, well, coming back to the Palantir holding our NHS data, private data, I mean, these, you know, they've done the AI, the Daddy's Home AI with Israel. We also know that there are various bodies that are conducting gain-of-function research and creating...
Still?
bioweapons.
I thought we realised that didn't work. It was Trump, a bad idea.
Yeah, they made it legal. They shipped it off overseas. shipped it to Ukraine. No. And Hunter Biden was involved, Metabiota, a company, and that was evidenced on his laptop that the New York Post reported on leading up to the 2016 election. And it was completely censored. I might have that. Wrong election.
17, maybe.
By Meta, at the request of Joe Biden and with help from the FBI, that pretended that they said it has all the hallmarks of a Russian disinformation campaign. What does that mean? Has all the hallmarks. They're not actually saying that it is a Russian disinformation campaign. We now know that they knew it was authentic, and they still have possession of this laptop. And CNN buried a story by one of their reporters who verified the authenticity of it as well. And this is quite a scandal. So leading up to a very tight election between Trump and Biden, this was after Trump's first term trying to be reelected. He narrowly lost, and imagine if that story had come out that Joe Biden's son, I mean, there's a lot of salacious stuff on this laptop too, which I don't care about, to be fair, but a lot of people would, tabloid stuff, you know, pictures of him with prostitutes, doing drugs, crack, a lot of people would care about that, I don't, but I do care that he was involved, this company Metabiota, doing illegal gain-of-function research on coronaviruses. Some of you might remember, listeners, that there was a pandemic which killed, according to the World Health Organization, 7 million people directly, 15 million indirectly. I mean, how many people died? I have to compare it to this, sorry, but the Holocaust, you know, 6 million people died. 7 million people at least died directly from this, and the president's son was involved in research that more and more seems to be clear that was the cause of this. You know, German intelligence says that they favor the lab leak very strongly. MI5, it's now come out from the beginning, favored the lab leak hypothesis. And the CIA is now also, it's been admitted. Trump has launched a new website, covid.gov, and it spells out, it's laying out a roadmap. You can see they're trying to come out and get justice for this. I'm very excited. Trump is, you know, very flawed in many respects, but he's given me a few fist pump moments. This was one.
Go on then.
And Tulsi Gabbard, you know, who I do respect, she spoke up on Assange. She trained in the military, and she has integrity. She talks about Snowden and Assange being important, she introduced legislation to protect whistleblowers, to add a public interest defense to the Espionage Act, which is crucial. So there's integrity and safety from war crimes. And she is leading a team investigating the origins of COVID. And she said last week that we are very close. She says we hope soon to announce the smoking gun of where COVID definitely came from.
Right.
And there was plenty of hints of where it came from, you know, that it was the lab
well, look,
and the game
just,
function.
Just as a bit of fun, can mm-hmm. we just go around the table, maybe starting mm-hmm. with you, Martin, in, mm-hmm. in one sentence, what's the origin of COVID? Where did it come from?
It was definitely produced. It's definitely what's the word? It's definitely an engineered virus. Mm. Jeffrey Sachs this week, if you know who he is,
he said
Jeffrey Sachs used to be the economist in charge of reform of the Russian economy, but he's now a very solid critic of Western policy all over the world and Israeli policy. He's Jewish. And he was saying that it's sourced in the University of North Carolina and Fort Detrick.
Yep.
So, in other words, and I would argue that it was deliberately released in China, not accidentally released.
Okay, we're also,
so it's all warfare.
We're also joined by Adil Raja, who's a former Pakistani army officer, who's very kindly come down to join us from London for a couple of days down in Bristol. Adil, what's in a couple of sentences, what's the origin of COVID?
Tony, I would definitely go ahead and I'll name an American physician, a very powerful American physician, but then I'll be facing another defamation suit in the Royal Court of Justice in London. Mm-hmm. I'm already facing one from the ISI.
So, could you write it down and one of us will say it?
A very famous American physician.
It might be the same one I know, but I'm prepared to say it.
So Adele is now scribbling away. We'll read it out to you. There's always a way.
Here we go.
What about you, Matt, whilst we're waiting?
I agree with what's written on that piece of paper.
Which
if you can make that out, Tony.
Oh, Dr. Fauci.
Oh, yes.
Oh, right, okay.
Oh, yes.
And that could or could not be what Adele has just passed me.
Who? Yes.
But
who,
Cadlech.
Luckily, got, you know, it's a genius racket as well, just financially. Like, he is the most highly paid federal employee in U.S. history. For a long time, he has been leading these gain-of-function. So if anyone doesn't know gain-of-function, it's making viruses, pathogens more effective. What would a more effective virus be? More deadly and more transmissible. So they are bioweapons. They pretend that they argue that they're creating them because what if somebody else made these? We need to find out how to defend against them. Which, you know, it's pretty spurious. They, you know, it's just like we can do a better job of monitoring. In this day and age, we should be able to monitor what's going on.
Follow the money.
Yeah, and not have to have anyone make them at all, because it's just so dangerous.
So if anyone's interested in this guy that may or may not be written down on this piece of paper in front of me, there is a book by a certain Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Called The Real Anthony Fauci. That's right. So that's done quite well, particularly over in the States, and it's possibly one of the reasons why he's now the health secretary over there.
Yeah,
but
that's brilliant. That's
anyway,
huge
can you just let listeners know, because I know you're off in a minute to go and play basketball.
Yeah.
How can listeners find you, follow you, Matt?
Yeah, Matt O'Brannon. It's Irish, so it's I'm just at Matt, letter O, Brannon, B-R-A-N-A-I-N. On Twitter, Instagram, mostly active there. Sort of on Facebook, but not really. That's generally.
And
me.
I think, you know what, because your caravan stuff we were talking about right at the very start, living in a caravan, this is a way to sort of free your soul in a weird way. That you're not feeling like you're doing something utterly pointless for someone you don't like or believe is doing the right thing.
Exactly.
So I think maybe even in the next couple of weeks, I'm going to try and keep focusing on this whole housing homelessness business. Because for me, it's absolutely the root of so much of what the Nudge Unit is basically doing, which is nudging people to do X, Y, and Z in order to, but basically threatening to evict everybody.
Yeah,
people who are on wages, whether it's they're paying a mortgage, whether they're paying rent, everyone is under this kind of covert threat from the evil Nudge Unit called the City of London, which is actually trying to enslave people. You know, they have all this stuff, don't they, about we want to stop modern slavery, but actually, by threatening to evict you unless you do X, Y, and Z, this is a kind of form of wage slavery or economic slavery, and money should be used to serve the public, not to enslave them. I just think that needs to be said. Anyway, thanks ever so much, Matt. And Adele, I suppose I'll sort of introduce you a little bit, because you have made a bit of a name for yourself after leaving the Pakistani army. Now, can you just tell us a bit about what you did, how you arrived in the army, and what you did whilst you were there?
Well, I was a Pakistan Army officer, third generation Pakistan Army officer ever since the country was created. My grandfather joined the army, he was a colonel. My dad was a major. I served the army for 21 years in the fighting arm, Armored Corps, and took voluntary retirement in 2016. And my LPR, that's leave pending retirement, finished in 2017 with full honors and awards. And I was in the war zone and active duty in the so-called global war against terror, which we call the war within in our country. So I was I got wounded there while fighting the war within, actually, and I was a war wounded officer at the time as well. And after 21 years service as a major, I took voluntary retirement, as I just told you. And after that, I was the spokesperson of the Pakistan Ex-Servicemen Society. That is an organization which is working with all the defense analysts, all the retired generals who would appear on the television shows and the mainstream media. They'll come over there, and I was the director media cell there as well. So I would coordinate with my country's intelligence agency. The most feared intelligence agency is called the ISI, Inter-Services Intelligence, whose senior commander is now a claimant against me in the Royal Court of Justice in the first time in the history of our country. That is also a first
time.
Well,
all I can say is good luck to them, because you can look after yourself.
Yeah, well, Tony, where it really hurts is that I have served that country as a third generation officer at the military as a third generation officer. I've given my share of blood. I was a war wounded officer. And even then, just because I spoke up, just because I was the voice of dissent, just because I supported Imran Khan, they court-martialed me in absentia. They've announced 14 years rigorous imprisonment against me. My mom is, you know, held hostage there in the country. She's not allowed to leave. She was abducted by them. I mean, nobody does that. That's really below the belt. And now they have started, the army chief, he has started a war because he's so unpopular, frankly. And he wants to get the popularity of Imran Khan, and he wants to continue his rule for another 10 years like all the generals in the military junta does. He initiated hostilities with India, and they're both nuclear countries we're talking about, right? The entire world is going to be affected by what they're trying to do over there. And now there is a war of testosterone going on, but the actual winner
actually
is
more, isn't it, drones this week? It's all going over to use of drones between. Yeah. Can you just say something about the background to the conflict between India and Pakistan? Because, I mean, as far as I know, this is a colonial conflict which was left simmering away by the Brits.
Yeah, definitely, Tony. We have talked about it, we talked about it on the South Asian mainstream media in India today as well. Basically, the Brits left the Kashmir issue unresolved there, and the Pakistan and India are fighting over Kashmir.
So am I right in thinking that there are parts of Kashmir which are controlled by Pakistan and some by India, yeah?
Yeah, that's true. That's correct, yeah. So almost half of it is controlled by India, and half of it is controlled by Pakistan. But what India did in 2019 was that they annexed that part, and they finished their special status, and they, you know, there's a special article, 370. They annulled it, and the Indian Parliament made it part of the Union Territory of India. And that gave China an opportunity to intervene, because the Chinese are already there in that area. They have captured the eastern Ladakh part. That is, that is almost the roof of the world above the Himalayas. So they're fighting over there. The Pakistanis and Indians are already fighting. This is called the war above the clouds in Siachen. I've served there. I mean, that's a place where the temperature in summers is minus 50 Celsius. So that's the kind of place you're fighting, and that's having an impact on the global environment, by the way. But you're fighting over there. So the country is fighting, both the countries are fighting over religious issues.
Yeah, look, this is the key as far as I'm concerned, because I see this in Northern Ireland, I've seen it in the Middle East. To what extent is this a religious conflict?
Well, to a large
extent. Or is religion being weaponized?
Yeah, it has been weaponized, definitely, because there is democracy in India, but democracy is majority rule, and there is a Hindu majority in India, and Hindutva, as in political ideology, has been weaponized by the current government in India, by the Modi government, and that ideology is being used to, I mean, the political ideology of Hindutva is being used for Hindu supremacy, and that is where the problem comes in. And Pakistanis, you know, they're told, this majority Muslim country, they've got their own issues, their sectarian issues, their 72 sects, all right? But the major issue is Hindu-Muslim issue. And the Hindus, well, there are almost a billion Hindus there in India and in the region, the subcontinent. So it is majorly, it is a religious issue. And that is why the two-nation theories was formulated by Jinnah, by Muhammad Ali Jinnah. And that's why he asked for the partition of the country on the basis of religion. But the interesting thing is that almost equal number of Muslims are still living in India, as much as they're in Pakistan. So how can the two-nation theory be? I mean, here's a question for you.
Yeah. Key to a lot of this is Imran Khan, I think. The idea that he's a very well-known, well-loved, well-respected, well-liked individual. The Americans told the Pakistanis, stick him in jail. Why did Pakistan do that?
Yeah, well, it was the Pakistani military generals who, in fact, misguided the Americans, and they told him that he's a dangerous guy, and they told him on the eve of the Russian attack in Ukraine, they told him to go to Moscow and beat Putin. And the day Russia attacked Ukraine, Imran Khan was sitting there in Moscow with Putin, and he was told to, you know, cancel his trip, cut it short, and go back. But he said, no, I'm not going to do that.
So he was set up, basically.
basically. Yeah, sounds like he was set up.
Yeah, he was set up. He was set up as his own generals. He was set up. And he was set up, and then they went to Washington, D.C., to the Americans, and they cried wolf. And they said, if he's not removed, well, the country, the nuclear-armed country, will fall in the Chinese lap or in the Russian lap. So you have to give us some kind of blessings. In fact, they sought the blessings, and the Assistant Secretary of State of the U.S., Donald Liu, write a cipher, which Imran Khan displayed. And he said that if you remove Imran Khan's government, there won't be any repercussions for you. Otherwise, well, you will have to face repercussions. And based upon that cipher, no confidence move was arranged by the Pakistani military, which actually rules the country. And Imran Khan was removed from power. And he was not only removed from power, now he's in jail. He was thrown into jail, along with his wife as well. And mind you, the kind of cases they've made against him, the cases are that why did he marry his wife before her ministerial cycles finished, that kind of stuff. How can you do that to a former prime minister, to a global star? He's a global sports star as well. I mean, he's a sports personality, a cricketing star, and a philanthropist. He made the first ever cancer hospital in our country. And then, you know, the problem over there was, Tony, frankly, if you allow me, I'll say that he came into power by being on one page with the military. That's the term we used. I used it yesterday in my interview with CNN News 18, that they asked me, what difference would it make for Imran Khan if he comes back to power? How would it change things for the country, you know? I said, well, previously, when Imran Khan was on one page, in the in-house discussion, he would tell us, and it is a well-acknowledged fact, that if you want to come in power, you have to cooperate with the military. But once you are in power, then you should work for civilian supremacy. And he tried that, and once he tried that, he was kicked out of power, he was thrown out of power, and he was thrown in jail.
Yeah, so, Marty Summers, can you just come in here a bit? Because we have a similar sort of thing going on here in Britain, don't we? I don't think we get the Prime Minister that we really want. We have somebody that has to, their coat has to be cut correctly, doesn't it? Whether it's from the City of London, foreign policy, or whatever. We do it in a kind of, I think, a less obvious way. We're not throwing our prime ministers in jail. We're just making sure that nobody that hasn't signed the proper documents and is going to say the right things gets a chance to stand.
Well, that's true in most countries who've got an internal hierarchy and a way of doing things. And, of course, Pakistan used to be part of the British Empire, so it's all linked. I mean, the current British government's policy, and it's supposedly a government of the left, is to support the current regime in Pakistan, because, and also they're tilting towards India over this latest conflict, and that's because they're told what to do by the Americans and the Israelis.
Who's the real? Who's? I mean, I love Jeremy Paxman, the BBC journalist, always used to say, "Who's in charge?" And he always used to ask that question. I've never heard, I think, hardly any journalists ask that question. Who's in charge here in Britain? Is it the military? Is it the city? Who's actually in charge, do you think, in making sure that they only get the prime ministers that they want rather than we want?
Well, Harold Wilson was removed in the 1970s by the Secret Services, MI5, working with, you know, with the Americans, because it was the Americans that the US had told the British Secret Service, MI5, that Wilson was a Russian spy. So that was the way in which Wilson was removed. But I mean, we can go. Once you start getting interested in politics, all of these things are going on. Who ultimately controls Britain is the ruling class.
I think, in a way, in
alliance with the Americans and the Israelis.
It's almost like you've got to watch The Wizard of Oz, haven't you? Because there's all this stuff going on. But actually, who's the guy behind the curtain? We'll be discussing this with former Pakistani officer Adil Raja and Martin after we've had a musical break. We'll be looking at Gaza and Pakistan and one or two other places around the world.
Then I saw in the right hand of the one sealed on the throne a scroll written on the inside and on the back, sealed with seven seals. And I saw a mighty angel proclaiming with a loud voice, "Who is worthy to open the scroll and break its seals?" And no one, in heaven or on earth or under the earth, was able to open the scroll or to look into it. And I began to weep bitterly, because no one was found worthy to open the scroll or to look into it. Then one of the elders said to me, "Do not weep. see, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the root of David, has conquered, so that he can open the scroll and its seven seals. Then I saw between the throne and the four living creatures, and among the elders a lamb, standing as if it had been slaughtered, having seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent out into all the earth. He went and took the scroll from the right hand of the one who was seated on the throne. When he had taken the scroll, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell before the Lamb, each holding a harp and golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints.
In his vision, St. John ascribes to Jesus attributes of two very contrasting animals. On the one hand, Christ assumes a majestic figure of a lion, the symbol of kingly rule over all the diverse creatures of the animal realm. On the other, he is the very antithesis of power, a lamb slaughtered as part of sacrificial ritual. Placing together these two contradictory images takes us into the very heart of the Christian faith. The one who begins as King and Lord must, if his creation is to be saved, empty himself of all power and become himself the victim. Only through his sacrifice can he return to his throne with his kingdom secured. The 20th century Christian writer and novelist C.S. Lewis perhaps expounded this most evocatively via the lion Aslan, who stands at the centre of the tale of the Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. This same combination of apparently contradictory creatures occurs in a much earlier description of the destiny of creation, one set out by the prophet Isaiah in chapter 65 of the book that bears his name. The wolf and the lamb shall feed together. The lion shall eat straw like an ox. Isaiah's vision implies a stage of creation well beyond this present earth, the digestive system of a carnivorous predator, but not readily mutating to that of a large herbivorous ruminant. But in God's reign, even the apparently irreconcilable can be brought together in harmony. It's a thought from which I take considerable comfort when reflecting on the intractability of so many present-day conflicts on earth.
He's coming on the clouds, kings and kingdoms will bow down, and every chain will break as broken hearts declare his praise. For who can stop the Lord Almighty? Our God is the Lion, the Lion of Judah. He's roaring in power and fighting our battles, and every knee will bow before him. And our God is the Lamb that was slain for the sins of the world. His blood breaks the chains, and every knee will bow before the Lion and the Lamb. Every knee will bow before him. Open up the gate, make way before the King of Kings. The God who comes to save is here to set the captives free. For who can stop the Lord Almighty? Our God is the Lion of Judah. He's roaring in power and fighting our battles, and every knee will bow before him. And our God is the Lamb that was slain for the sins of the world. His blood breaks the chains, and every knee will bow before the Lion and the Lamb. Every knee will bow before him.
On the rock, and then I take a stalk.
Et de cellophane cheveux chinois, passe par à la une gueule de bois. A bu ma bière dans un grand verre en caoutchouc. Comme un alien dans son igloo. S'envoyer du paillasson, limé, ruiné, vidé, comblé. You are the king of the divan, qu'elle me dit en passant. Ooh, I am the king of the divan. Ça plane pour moi. Ça plane pour moi.
Sa plan pour moi. That's Plastic Bertrand. remember it very well from 1977. Before that, we had Bob Marley with it's called Iron Lion Zion, 1992. And at the very beginning was this morning's Daily Service from the BBC, which is now, of course, on some sort of digital dungeon somewhere. So you can't get that on long wave, medium wave, FM, any of the normal channels, and that was an extract from the Book of Revelation. So thank you very much to the BBC for doing that. There's one of the little jobs that you see. We all love to hate the BBC, but they still do some good stuff. In fact, we're going to be hearing something else, I think, either next week or later tonight, Martin. I don't know if you heard the BBC series called Steak Knife. 10-part series. Absolutely brilliant piece of incisive journalism, looking at all sorts of interference by MI5 and the army in the troubles in Northern Ireland. Really, really good. And the fact that the British Army were running the Nutting Squad in the IRA, so the person who was executing suspicious so-called members of the IRA was working for the British Army. So the BBC do some good bits and bobs. So welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling, speaking to you from a corner of freedom close to central Bristol in the west of England. And we're also joined by Adil Raja, who's Soldier Speaks on Twitter, but he's also all sorts of things, including a big campaigner for Imran Khan. And Matt has given me a couple of questions to ask you, and now he's disappeared off. Most importantly, how do we free Imran Khan? I think everyone wants to know. You're a military officer. I can imagine you sitting there thinking about we could need a few tanks there and maybe some paratroopers and this sort of thing. But I mean, from a political process and a judicial process, how do we get him out?
Tony, your name of your show should be Trouble Show, you know. And just to tell you, I have been arrested in the UK on under the counterterrorism laws just because of supporting Imran Khan. I was arrested by the counterterrorism police in front of my kids. I was taken in, of course, and I was kept on bail for 9 months All right. And the case ended with a no further action and an apology, informal apology. And good, the good. Police, I mean, they compensated me for breaking my computer and stuff. But I have been through all that. And now you're asking me for the kind of the military strategy.
No, no.
I'm not going to give you that.
No. Okay. So I think it's when Julian Assange was also in jail here in Belmarsh prison. There were people thinking, well, look, let's spring him from prison. I mean, this is just a normal thing. People will think this is you might see it as a vigilante action, but many people would also see it as justice.
Johnny, in my case, it was the state of Pakistan, the Pakistani military, which complained to the British government that he's instigating violence abroad in the Pakistan, just because I was asking people to come out. And on a serious note, that is the only way Imran Khan would come out on people's term, on his own term. If people of Pakistan come out for a peaceful democratic protest, there is no other way. But the way things are in Pakistan, people have been suppressed. The dissent is being suppressed through force. There are people are being extrajudicially murdered by the military, by the intelligence arm, ISI, and the military intelligence. People are turned into missing person. You just don't know where they are. Just for an example, there is a very famous journalist. His name is Ahmad Noorani. And he is working from the U.S., from Washington, D.C. Just because he is speaking against the current regime, two of his brothers have been abducted and they were made into missing person. And since there was international hue and cry from the press freedom organizations, they were found a month or so later in this remote area. And it was told, the covering story was that these were dacoits who had abducted them. But they were lucky, in fact. Most of the Pakistanis are not lucky.
Do you want to just say that a dacoit is not a term you hear very often these days over here? What is a dacoit?
Well, dacoit is an armed robber. And there are groups of dacoits in Pakistan. And they get their patronage from the politicians in Sindh. We are talking about Sindh. And mostly in Sindh, there's the area of Indus Basin. It's called, the area is called Kacha. Kacha means not firm. All right, so there are jungles there. There are thick vegetation, and there are gangs of dacoits living there, and they loot and plunder.
It sounds like a sort of Pakistani version of the Thuggees.
Yeah, well, that's is what it is.
And in fact, if anyone is interested in dacoits, you can read all about them in the Sax Roma's books of Fu Manchu. He was actually a member of Aleister Crowley's Golden Dawn, lived in Reigate, and he knew what he was writing about. He was writing about the occult, that is to say, the things that go on that don't get talked about on the mainstream media, on the television. Anyway, back to the main question. Yeah. Let's get your tanks, let's get your paratroopers, let's get your headquarters units, your engineers, put them aside for one moment. From a judicial and a political process, how can we release? I mean, we did it with Julian Assange.
Yeah.
He's out. How can we get Imran Khan out and back in his job?
You've got rule of law in the country where Julian Assange was. So Julian Assange got free because of a legal battle, right? But in our country, in Pakistan, there is no rule of law.
I think it was more of a deal.
The white is the rule.
Well, hang on. It was more of a deal that was done between the Australians, the British and the Americans behind the scenes. There were lots of court attempts to do it, which failed. But actually, it was a diplomatic move. So do you think Khan's got friends out there in the wider world that might be able to pull some diplomatic strings to get him back in, especially if Pakistan is drifting away from US influence?
So it's a two-pronged strategy. First, a country of 250 million, at least 1%, that is 2.5 million people, they need to come out and protest. That is going to do the trick. And if that is happening, there are already diplomatic, maneuvers.
But have people given up and gone home? There were protests.
No, there were protests, yeah. There were protests. Many people have been, the latest was on the 26th of November, 24th of November 2024, in which, as per my information, 105 people were killed, unaccounted for, and their dead bodies were stolen. And they were buried in unmarked graves, and they're still unaccounted for, and then nobody's allowed to talk about them. So that is the result. That is the kind of brutality we are facing, and we are talking about in the heart of in the capital of the country, right? So still, people have to, they have to come out for peaceful protest, and otherwise, the overseas Pakistani community or the diaspora, it's a very strong. There's a very strong diaspora in America.
In this city, you've got a very strong. community in Bristol, yeah.
In the UK. Unfortunately, in the UK, and that's going to be something very controversial. But,
careful.
Yeah, I've got to be careful there. But you've got a Labour government there, right? And there are a lot of Pakistani MPs here, right? But they all have got such good terms with the Pakistani military junta, right?
And but the don't RSI. The military
and the reason is, and the reason is because they're constituents, they need to get their jobs done in Pakistan, and you cannot get the jobs done without the Pakistani intelligence, ISI, or the army involved. So that, but that's not the case in the USA. So the US American Pakistani community, they have lobbied, and you know, the representative Joe Wilson have come out with Pakistan Democracy Act, which directly names, directly calls on Magnitsky style sanctions on the General Asim Munir, the Pakistani Army Chief. Mm-hmm. So that is something which is really.
But don't the Pakistani Army, the senior officers, don't they see it makes sense to have a democratic civil government? They just want, because they're starting to lose control, aren't they? They're starting to lose popularity. They're starting to lose control. They're edging towards potentially a war with India. Is that really what they want?
Well, the war with India is all a separate topic because they are losing control. You're right, Tony. And because the reason they're losing control, losing popularity, they have ignited this India-Pakistan hatred. And General Asim Munir himself, you know, we were there other day. We were there on the mainstream media, we discussed it quite openly. And I still stand by what I said, that it was General Asim Munir who started the attack in Kashmir, so that this war, which is being fought right now, I'm a warlike situation, it gets instigated and the things heat up so that he ride upon the anti-India hatred. And the same thing is done by Indians, by the way. They ride on the politicians there, ride on the anti-Pakistan hatred.
I mean, surely the senior military in Pakistan sees that this kind of thing can blow back in their faces.
Yeah, it's only here you need to understand that the senior military in Pakistan, they're more interested in becoming multimillionaires. If you become a general, you are the worth, which is legally, your legal worth would be somewhere around $25 million, all right? And if you become a lieutenant general, 3-star, you will be a billionaire. All right, in the US dollars. That's the kind of perks and privileges they award themselves. So if there is democracy in the country, like there is democracy in India, all right, let's compare it because that's the region we're talking about and that's the same region. There is democracy in India, right? And the Indian generals, they're living in 3-bedroom flats, right? And the Pakistani generals, they're living in 3,000 acres of, you know, farm. That's normal. They've got farms, states here in the UK, Scotland is their favorite spot to get states, right? And they can afford it. Like in Wales, the biggest nursing home system, the old people's care house system, is owned by a Pakistani general. They are so rich, all right? And how do they become so rich? How do they amass this kind of wealth? By being in control of the policy-making bodies of the country, by being in control of the government. The Pakistani military runs the biggest business empire in the country. And to sustain that, they need public support. If they'll have public support, they'll be able to justify their actions.
Yeah, but they're losing that, aren't they?
Yeah, they are losing. This is the last part after 75
years. You're also accusing the Pakistanis of being behind this terrorist attack.
I'm not accusing Pakistanis. I'm not accusing Pakistanis. I'm accusing the Pakistani army chief.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what evidence do you have for that? Is it just hearsay, your contacts tell you that, or what?
Well, Tony, the proof is in the pudding, all right?
The proof of the pudding is in the eating.
Yeah, well, yeah. That's true. Well, who's benefiting from it? Actually, the Chinese are benefiting from it. That's a different story. But because of this, India-Pakistan thing, General Asim Munir will, you know, he's positioning himself to get his extension. Now, Tony, for the last 3 years, these are the sources who've been telling me, well, for example, this same guy, Asim Munir, 35 days before his appointment, they told me that two of them, the generals, told me that he's going to be the next army chief, and I tweeted about it.
Right.
Yeah.
So you've got a bit of a track record in getting this right.
It's okay. Not that's bit of a drop. Enough, yeah, all right. Okay. All right. Let's hold me accountable. Audit me, and you'll find I've got 90% track record. I was telling CNN yesterday in my interview there, CNN News 18. I've got a track record of 90% accuracy, Tony. That's not. That's something you cannot just ignore and brush under the carpet as hearsay.
No.
Right.
No. Okay, fine. You talked about the war within. This is something which we don't, I mean, maybe people in Northern Ireland might remember something about a war within over there. But what is that, and what's that, what's been going on in Pakistan?
Well, Tony, in the 1980s, we started our intelligence agency, ISI and CIA, they started this jihad against the USSR. Since they were knocking at the doors, they were in Afghanistan, they took over Afghanistan. So we started this international jihad, religious war against USSR, which succeeded, definitely succeeded. But in doing so, there was a lot of funding and of money from the Americans, and the ISI managed it. A lot of generals got rich, but there were a lot of mullahs who formed a mullahcracy in our country. They formed their own independent militant groups, all right? And those militant groups have got their own huge, like the recent attack by India was targeting two of such groups. So we've got a history of starting from 1980s of formation of these groups who would then take, Americans just left after USSR broke in 1980. They said, well, job done. Bye-bye, we are going.
But they left all these guys hanging around.
Yeah, they left them hanging around, and we had, and instead of, you know, rehabilitating them, since I've been a de-radicalization expert in my country as well, once I was serving in the army, that's a separate topic, but we have been, you know, bringing back these militants into the mainstream by teaching them different trades and then investing in them to start small businesses. But these guys, this was not done in the 1980s after the USSR broke, and these groups were taken on as proxies by our own intelligence agencies, but they, even the ISI and the military intelligence, the military do not control these groups because they are so huge. For example, there was Al-Qaeda, right? Osama bin Laden was in Pakistan. He was being protected by the Pakistani intelligence. And one of the Pakistani intelligence colonel, his name was Iqbal, he walked into the U.S. embassy and he said, well, there's a $25 or $50 million bounty on Osama bin Laden. Give it to me and I'll give you Osama. And he took the bounty. Now he's staying somewhere in the U.S. and he gave them, handed them over to Osama. And well, these kind of people, they were once the hot favorite Mujahideen, darling of the US, darling in Washington DC, and being managed by Islamabad, Pakistan, they became the terrorist. And now the problem is that these are, in fact, I call them the international ideological mercenaries. Yeah. They formed the ISIS. ISIS, there's a big chunk of these people who are a part of the ISIS now, right? And ISIS, somebody airlifted ISIS
You've got a major problem here with groups like this.
Yeah.
Once you've set them up, what happens if someone else comes along and offers to double their pay?
Well, that's already happening, you know. It's an ecosystem of terror forming in my country. That's the problem. And this ecosystem of terror forming, they go for the highest bidder because they don't need financing from the Pakistani military. They've got their own finances. They've got their own welfare organizations looking after their own people. And there's so much unemployment, so much, poverty in my country, in Pakistan, that there is a constant, and a country of 250 million, where 60% people are youth, all right? So there's a constant stream of soldiers or foot soldiers or manpower available for these groups. And these are the groups who, and the people who cannot join army, there's a limited number of seats in the army, in the military, in the army, air force, and navy. Well, they go ahead and they join these groups then because they are providing them, at least they're giving them food and shelter. So that's enough, you know, that's even enough. And then somebody comes along, like Indians, they hired the same groups once they were de-inducted from Kashmir under General Musharraf. You got to give them job, these mercenaries. These are mercenaries, third generation mercenaries. You got to give them jobs. So they had the job in Kashmir. But then the Indian made a strategic alliance with the U.S. in 2002, 2003, and the U.S. put pressure on General Musharraf, and General Musharraf said, all right, take a U-turn on Kashmir policy, bring them all back. They were brought back. They were out of job. So there are allegations that the Indians, you know, they hired them for sitting in Afghanistan, and they said, well, the Pakistani state, they're supporting the Americans. So they said they gave a fatwa against them, a religious addict. And they said, well, they need to be killed. And well, there you go. You got a taste of your own medicine, and it's still going on.
OK, well, let's bring it up to today, because this week's been quite momentous, actually. We've had shelling across the border. And also, I mean, I've been seeing reports of, I think, of both sides, reports from both sides, aircraft being lost.
Yeah.
So what's happening?
Yeah, what's happening, Tony?
What's been happening this week?
Reuters reported that two of Indian Rafale, at least one Rafale jet, is that this is $800-900 million per jet, right? French-made Rafale jets, right? They have been shot down by the Chinese J-10C being operated by the Pakistani Air Force, and that has seen the Chinese defense stock of Chengdu Air Complex, that which makes the Chinese aircraft skyrocket, right? So who is actually
benefiting? Sorry, is it a Chinese anti-aircraft or
Chinese fighter aircraft manufacturing is in Chengdu Air Warfare.
Right.
Their shares have skyrocketed overnight, you know? It's pure business going on. You see, follow the money. Who's benefiting from Indian-Pakistan war? Not India, not Pakistan. The Chinese are, definitely.
And the military-industrial complex.
Of course, the military-industrial complex. Complex is going to get, or they are going to get orders, but I think Indians are going for the Russian Su-57.
It may well be. Okay, so there's a lot of worries because both are nuclear armed powers.
Yeah.
Should people be really worried? Is there really any chance that that might happen?
Well, here's the thing, you know, my information, and I've written about it, and we talked about it on the mainstream media. We were sitting there together as well. There is a Chinese angle to it, and it is all part of a global power rivalry, where in China and America, the USA, the two giants, they are in this, you know, who'll become the next superpower and who wants to control that part of the world, at least for now, who want to control Asia Pacific. That's where the future is. And in this trade war, the American wants to shift some manufacturing base away from China, because that is what empowers China, right? So, like the Apple phone manufacturing, they are trying to move it to India. So if China engages India through Pakistan and does not get involved itself. Definitely, India is a very big market. They want to make use of the market as well. But if Pakistan keeps India engaged using the Chinese weapon, what's going on is India won't be able to concentrate on their developing their manufacturing hub, which the America and West want. That's first advantage to China. Second advantage is that what we have seen is the way the Chinese weapons are operating against the Western weapons, like the French Rafale jets, their stock shares are going, they're rising up, all right? That is also there. And thirdly, but India's got a lot many options to punish Pakistan, and Pakistan is already being punished. The people of Pakistan not in the war. Why I say that tomorrow there's an India does not need the money. They can afford to lose. There are Israeli drones which have been shot down in Pakistan. There was Indian drones, right? That they've been shot down. But the Indians can afford it, all right? They've got a lot of money there. Pakistan is, on the other hand, is a country which is running its economy on loan, and they need a bailout package from IMF, what, $7 billion, and there is a conference tomorrow in Washington, D.C., and Indians are going all out, as New York Times reported as well, that they don't want them to have that money. And that's not only that, not only there, but then there is a FATF conference coming up in June, and Pakistan really made a lot of efforts to come out of the grey list of Financial Action Task Force because of sponsoring terrorism. But now, if they go back into the grey list, they'll be in trouble. And who's going to bail them out? China? I don't think so.
So where's Pakistan's friends? Well, the generals are obviously feeling they can rule the roost without Imran Khan, but they're running out of options.
Right now, Pakistan is, if the Western world support Pakistan, and if they support democracy in Pakistan, that is in their favor. In fact, bring back Imran Khan, and that is why there is a Pakistan Democracy Act in the U.S. Congress. If that goes through, Pakistan will stay at least a bit in the Western camp and a bit in the Eastern camp. But right now, the Pakistani army chief, he's practically sitting in the Chinese lap, don't mind me saying this, but I think I can say this in the, on this your radio show, the kind of stuff you've been saying, Tony.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, this is not a big deal, yeah? So, yeah, right now, the present army chief, he has got no other option because he's being named in the Pakistan Democracy Act, but to extend his rule, he is now cooperating with Beijing, and there was a report in Reuters, today's Telegraph, I was reading the story in which it was written that 4 a.m. in the morning, the Chinese ambassador in Pakistan was, you know, he was given a call to celebrate the downing of the Chinese, Indian jets there. So the Chinese, what benefit did Pakistan get out of it? You know, Pakistan is going to face financial troubles, financial sanctions because of it, just because the Pakistani army chief wants an extension in his tenure. And the people of Pakistan, for the first time in the history of the country, are not supporting its military wholeheartedly.
Yeah, but you've got, India has got roughly twice the army of Pakistan, am I right?
Yeah, and five times bigger economy than Pakistan.
But is it going to come to a real fisticuffs? I mean, really, some kind of an all-out war or hitting big strategic targets? Do you think they've got the, I mean, have either side got any ambitions? Because, of course, the superpowers don't necessarily care too much about Indians or Pakistanis if they've got something to gain out of it.
Johnny, there's so many, such a big nuclear arsenal there, and neither Americans want it, nor the Chinese want it, because they're in the same neighborhood, neither the Indians or Pakistani want it, because it's a mad scenario, mutually assured destruction scenario. You cannot go nuclear. Although, this present army chief, Asim Munir, if he's allowed to continue, he's the kind of man with the kind of emotional and mental instability, as called out by Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad, that he's got certain issues, he's got certain inferiority complexes. So he can do anything, you know. He's a monkey with a matchbox in his hand.
I think actually you've got a similar thing. Many leaders around the world have got inferiority complexes, and
they don't have their finger on the nuclear button, do they?
Well, some of them do here in Britain, in the United States. And just as an aside, I think this idea of you doing investigative journalism as a former army officer, I'd just like to expose a chap called Alastair Bruce, who I've seen a lot of on the news this week, on Sky News. Alastair Bruce is the royal correspondent for Sky News. He's on the TV quite a lot. In fact, he's been doing all of the coverage of the VE Day celebrations that we've had on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And so what I'd like to do is just, from a British point of view and a World War II and a World War III point of view, so we've just been talking about a nuclear exchange, possibly, let's have a listen to him first of all, and then I'd like to hear a little bit of King Charles' speech about VE Day, and then a little bit from his arch enemy, Vladimir Putin. So let's have a listen to that, because I think this puts all in context. What's going on in the wider world is also getting rather dangerous. So first of all, Alastair Bruce, here he is. The idea is you're not supposed to know that he's a major general. They actually did have a report on the TV about him being made a companion of the Order of the Bath by King Charles. So in two different ways, the king is his boss. In the Order of the Bath, he's his boss, and also in the army, he's the commander in chief of this guy. And here he is walking around on the television, pretending to be an impartial royal correspondent.
I'm not quite sure what companion of the bath means. I think, in a sense, I have to bath alone still. So this is companion of the bath in the military division, and it comes at the end of nearly 46 years in uniform, most of which I've been working too for Sky News. So I'm extremely grateful to my employer for letting me serve in the way that I have. So it's really great to have it. But I'm not quite sure what companion of the bath means. I think, in a sense, I have to bath alone still. This year is the 80th anniversary of VE Day, when victory came to Europe at the end of the Second World War. Here's everything you need to know. VE Day stands for Victory in Europe Day. But what exactly is it? To understand it, we need to go back to the Second World War.
Okay, so there's Alistair Bruce doing his infant school report about what the Second World War was and why we have something called VE Day. The celebrations or the commemoration this week has been big, but the point is, why is somebody who's supposed to be reporting impartially on royal affairs also under the orders in different fashions of the king? This just seems very medieval. But anyway, I mean, you're an investigative journalist. What do you make of the idea that you've got somebody who's supposed to be impartial, but actually they're under orders?
Well, it's a unique example, but it's not a new concept. The embedded journalism as a concept was introduced. We were told in the textbook, military textbook, that it was a concept introduced by the Americans, but hearing this general, it tells me that the idea came from the Brits. So, yeah, embedded journalism is... I mean, it is a thing which is now quite regular, but an officer who is serving at the same time he's a journalist, that's a unique case, Tony. I haven't heard about this one.
Well, I think there are several around, and the idea is also that some of them are reserve army officers. I mean, we've had discussions on this program quite a lot over the years about the misuse of journalism and journalists, specifically journalists. So, for example, home affairs correspondents of most of the national press in this country, according to Charles Shoebridge, who's a former army officer and also special branch officer, he says basically they are, and he said it on this program, that they are the public relations people for MI5, for the security services, and also ones who are foreign correspondents are often they are basically PR people for MI6. So I don't think many of the public realise that that these people get to where they are by taking a lot of their stories from the intelligence services.
Yeah, Tony, it's not new normal, actually. All the modern militaries in the world have got their PR wings. Like, we have got inter-services public relations. They carry out information operations as well. And there's a specialist directorate of information operations, which is, in fact, a propaganda warfare. Like the modern Goebbels outfield is now renamed as information operation. Then you've got domestic media wings. Then you've got audio and visual media wings. And you've got officers doing that. I mean, and you do need that kind of a PR mechanism, and that you do need that kind of a psychological operations and psyops, mechanisms. Fine, all right. But till the time it is declared, if it is not declared, then there is a problem. And otherwise, you know, these outlets, they do feed stories to the mainstream media. I mean, like in the case of Reuters latest story about India Pakistan, they quoted two American officers. They said, we cannot name them, but Pakistani the two Indian jets have been shot down, and they're confirming it, but you don't name them. But once it's coming from official sources, you're not naming them, but it's coming from official sources, then even the so-called AI, you know, they're also going to confirm that, yeah, well, these are the official sources. What are official sources, in fact? Anybody from the PR mechanism of a particular state, I mean, they tell you that, well, this is the story, and you don't have to name us, and we are leaking it to you, and that's an official source, and everybody is going to then, even BBC Verify will do a story. Well, it's verified because it's an official source saying it, you know. So that's how you manipulate public opinion.
I mean, what annoys me is that journalism has definitely changed within my lifetime. I think many of these people who are spokespeople for the secret state, you would, and they're in their suits, they're the journalists, they're on the television. Really, they should be sitting on one side of the debate, that we should have a debate with them on the one side, saying this is the security service point of view, not them deciding the debate and steering the debate. They should be, they should have their voice, they should be your spokespeople, but also it should be absolutely open about who they are. Anyway, so it's a big... Martin, I think I ought to bring you in on this a little bit, because it's a big week, isn't it, this VE Day, and it's been Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. I think it's the longest VE Day I can ever remember in my lifetime. I think the idea is, I think there's an attempt to sort of milk the whole thing. But also we've had Ukrainian troops, haven't we, marching in London with the British Army.
That's right. Well, if you remember the 50th anniversary, we got a day off, yeah, 30 years ago. There was a whole day off, but we didn't get a day off this time. And, of course, it's been a big deal Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday in this country, And of course, in Russia,
it was on Monday too. I mean, it was the stuff.
Yeah, well,
on
they, because Monday was the May Bank holiday, yeah. Supposedly May the 1st, you know, the workers' holiday or whatever, but we put it on a Monday here, so that they took that over as a you know, more,
Friday
more
was
the,
Friday was the Russians' day.
Friday
today.
Was the Russians, because they got they the surrender in Germany was on a the 8th in the US, yeah, because they're on the other side of the world, but in Moscow it was on the 9th, which is why you've got a separate, you know, the separate days, the 8th and the 9th. So obviously we've had our version, and the Russians have had their version.
But there was never any sort of peace treaty seemed to be needed between the Soviet Union and the Allies, the British and the Americans, was there? Although it was all, it hotted up pretty much straight away.
Well, I mean,
The Cold War.
Well, I mean, the possibility of something more constructive was there, but it didn't happen. Not least because you've got people like Churchill, for example, saying, we've got nuclear weapons, why don't we nuke them now?
But there was the main problem for me was seeing these Ukrainians in with the British. Well, if you look at the Ukrainian army in the Second World War, it was mostly on the side of the Nazis.
Yes, the Ukrainian Banderites were fighting. They clashed with the Nazis at some stages, but the Baba Yar massacre outside Kiev, for example, was carried out by local militias, not by the Germans.
And we've had, right since World War II, since the creation of the Central Intelligence Agency, the American CIA has been, a bit like in Pakistan with these proxies, has been encouraging Nazis in Ukraine as a stick to beat the Soviet Union with. So they've been being funded over there, and they're still around.
They are, yes. And, of course, it goes back to the very end of the war. Loads of Ukrainians escaped to the West, including Bandera himself, who was then, you know, he lived in exile from Ukraine in Germany. He was assassinated by the KGB in Munich in 1959. And, of course, the current regime in Kiev has got plenty, you know, they've renamed loads of streets after Bandera. They've put loads of statues of him up. There's a historical antagonism, a bit like in Yugoslavia, where I was in the 90s, an aid worker. The Second World War was messy, so different communities took different sides, and that antagonism remains. And it doesn't necessarily have to lead to conflict, but if outside forces are encouraging it, then it does. And
now,
it has.
I've had a bit of a personal story, you could say, this week, which has actually popped up in the Daily Telegraph, about the Second World War, which to me is an absolutely disgusting way to remember or not remember what happened in the Second World War. The Battle of Britain's Heroes Hut has been demolished. A wooden dispersal hut was a place for pilots to unwind between sorties during the relentless bombing of London. This is at Biggin Hill Airfield, where I worked for about 3 or 4 years years ago. In fact, I know some of the people that work next door to the hut that's been demolished. A wooden hut used by the Battle of Britain heroes during the Second World War has been demolished. Biggin Hill Airport bosses have knocked down a 1940s building and arranged for some of its parts to be exported to the United States. Despite the local council chiefs refusing to give permission, known as the dispersal hut, the wooden building was thought to be one of just two original structures in the airport dating back to the Battle of Britain. So this is particularly irritating because it's something which I've heard is that the airport operators just covered it with tarpaulin for about 6 months or so, and all of the locals assumed and had been told that it was being renovated. They turned up one Monday morning, the whole hut had been demolished. So this is how we remember those that protected London in the Spitfires and Hurricanes of World War II. We just demolished their hut. And in fact, what's happening now is the local council, Bromley Council, is taking the airport operators to the High Court for disobeying their instructions, which were to look after and renovate the hut. Anyway, so that's, I found that particularly disgusting, that sort of thing is allowed to take place. And luckily and thankfully, the local authority is taking them to court, but they'll hire the best barristers they can. They're a very wealthy airport, and they'll take them to the cleaners, maybe. Anyway, let's go on to King Charles. And let's hear what he had to say about VE Day this week. He didn't mention the dispersal hut at Biggin Airport for all sorts of obvious reasons, but he did talk about the conflicts then and now.
So, in remembering the past, we must also look to the future. As the number of those who lived through the Second World War so sadly dwindles, the more it becomes our duty to carry their stories forward, to ensure their experiences are never to be forgotten. We must listen, learn, and share, just as communities across the nation have been doing this week at local street parties, religious services, and countless small acts of remembrance and celebration. And as we reach the conclusion of the 80th anniversary commemorations, we should remind ourselves of the words of our great wartime leader, Sir Winston Churchill, who said, "Meeting jaw to jaw is better than war." In so doing, we should also rededicate ourselves not only to the cause of freedom, but to renewing global commitments to restoring a just peace where there is war, to diplomacy, and to the prevention of conflict. For as my grandfather put it, we shall have failed, and the blood of our dearest will have flowed in vain if the victory which they died to win does not lead to a lasting peace founded on justice and established in goodwill.
So let's hear from both of you. Maybe you first, Adil. What do you make of King Charles's speech and his prospects for the future and Britain's role in world peace at the moment?
Tony, Britain is, as far as, I mean, there are too many questions, but let me just start by the Second World War. There were a large number of Indians and Pakistanis who took part in the Second World War. One of them was my great-grandfather. He was the, his name was Sardar Niaz Ali Khan, and he was the sergeant, I don't know what you call the, there used to be different kind of ranks. He was a junior commissioned officer. That was the highest rank in those days a Muslim could get. So he refused to fight against the Turks, and that's why he was sent to Myanmar. We used to call it Kalapani. That's where the streak of, speaking truth to power comes. And, he was brought back because all the elders of my clan went to see the Viceroy at New Delhi.
Oh, yeah.
And they said that if our boy is not brought back, we were a martial, so were so-called martial clan. None of our boys in the Rajputs, the Chib Rajputs, would join the Royal Army. So they were short of manpower. They needed the manpower. My great-grandfather did come back. But there were a lot of Indians and Pakistanis who fought in the Second World War. And I see it as something which is not a very well-acknowledged fact here in the UK, because I've had debates about this, and people would tell me, the military community, they would tell me, yeah, well, they were there, but, you know, they were not really a significant number. Well, they were a significant number.
So whereabouts were they fighting?
They were fighting in North America against Rommel, right? Against
North Africa.
North Africa. North Africa. And in the Middle East. And they were involved in Burma, present-day Myanmar. Yeah. So they went as far as in they faced the Japanese army, yeah. They faced the German army directly, and it was because of them, especially because the sappers, the engineers, because of whom, a large part of North African campaign was successful. and they were fighting under General Montgomery as well. So, acknowledging the Indians and Pakistanis who fought for you.
That's quite important. But look, what about today? Yeah. What about Britain's role in world peace today? Yeah, well, let's finish on that one.
Yeah, so Britain, as I see it, is right now in the post-colonial world order. Britain extend is a bridge between the American influence to the rest of the world because these two powers across the pond. And that's how Britain, I see in the modern world, is exercising its influence, its soft power, actually, that they are, you know, representing American interests. The British foreign policy is influenced by the American foreign policy. I know people don't like it currently once President Trump is there, like Ed Davey said that, well, we're going our own way now since President Trump is there and he does not agree with his policies, fine, especially in particularly with when Ukraine is conflict, you know, with regards to the Ukraine conflict. But Americans still are getting their way, and Britain are, you know, using the American influence and becoming a bridge between America and the rest of the world.
Okay, so is Britain a force for peace today?
I would say no comments there.
Anyway, okay, Martin, what do you make of King Charles's comments there and Britain's place in the world for peace or otherwise?
Well, if you actually take the words that he spoke, there's nothing there that to take offence at. He's saying, yes, we must remember the past. And, of course, he's stressing that, you know, war's a bad thing. And, you know, if we didn't, you know, we won the war so that we could have a peace. All of which is unexceptional stuff. He's the head of the Church of England. You'd expect him to say that sort of thing.
Yeah, his granddad was George the VI.
Yes, I know, but he was also head of the Church of England. Because
his great-uncle was Edward VIII, yes, who I know. Was a Nazi.
That's right. So, in other words, there's the politics of... The royal family have always had political views in this country. The idea that they're apolitical is silly. It's a supposedly constitutional state. They some parts of the world they've got rid of the head of state being.
You don't think it is really a constitutional state. It's pretending.
Well, no, it's not. I'm just saying that in terms of what he's actually saying there, it's unacceptable.
Is it connected to reality?
Well, not really, because the reality is that we're embedded in these power structures that Adil's just mentioned, the Americans, and of course the Israelis are a massive influence in this country via the Americans and by their own influence. And, years ago, George W. Bush referred to the axis of evil, by which he meant Iran, Iraq, North Korea. But the real axis of evil in the world is Israel, Britain, United States.
Well, how can it be? He's saying, look, we want to talk. We don't want war. We want George Orwell like Winston Churchill.
Well, apart from in Ukraine, where he's absolutely up for that we're going to fight. And, of course, they're saying that they want talks in Israel between Israel and Palestine, but we can't talk to Hamas, who are the elected leaders of Palestine. So when you actually drill down into what the actual policy is, all of those fine words just disappear like candy floss, and there's nothing, no meat to them.
So, so what about prospects for peace generally?
Well, obviously, we're in a very dangerous international situation, probably the most dangerous since 1945, because it's not just one thing going on. We've got stuff in the subcontinent, we've got stuff in the Middle East, we've got stuff in Europe. 1 million young men have died fighting for the Ukrainian cause in Ukraine. That's a lot of people.
Well, look, I mean, let's just take a step back. I mean, let's sit on the moon and look down on planet Earth for a minute. There are quite a lot of conflict zones, aren't there, around? It almost seems to me as if each of these conflicts is being brought to a stage, the Middle East, no exception, Ukraine, no exception, Pakistan, India, no exception, where a small hair trigger could kick the whole thing off.
Well, I'll,
what the United Nations is there to stop, prevent it even getting to this stage.
Well, I'll make a point on that, and I'll ask the interested to hear Adolf's view. The problem with modern technology, weaponry, is that a tiny mistake watching an incoming blip on your screen can lead you to take steps which you can't untake. So in the 1980s, when we were facing off with the Soviet Union, we nearly had a nuclear war in Europe because a flock of swans flew very, very close to the radar that was being picked up by the Soviets, as it then was. And of course, if you put nuclear missiles closer and closer to other people, like India and Pakistan, they're absolutely face to face. But of course, the Intermediate Missile Treaty, which ended the Cold War, took all of those short range or medium range missiles out of Europe. And then the West has brought them back in, which is one of the reasons why the Russians... If the Russians were to put short-range missiles in Cuba, would Donald Trump think that was reasonable? And the answer is no, he wouldn't. And that's the problem we've got, because the technology can easily lead, especially if the political situation is so fragile, that some stupid mistake by some low-level person could easily just set the whole thing going. Now, I'd be interested to hear what Adil's professional opinion is of that.
Yeah, Martin, there are checks and balances once you're talking about strategic weapons. All the strategic weapon infrastructures, they're being centrally controlled. I mean, no one person can, just switch on the button. So there are checks and balances involved in the Chinese model as well, in the Russian model as well, and the Pakistani-Indian model as well, based on the American model. In fact, the Pakistani nuclear infrastructure, the Army Strategic Force Command, has been funded by the Americans, by the way, to have the kind of checks and balances they have got. So just imagine, So that's not going to happen, all right? There are too many moving parts as far as, Tony, the conflict zones are concerned. All the different conflict zones are related to different kind of, at the end of the day, at the bottom of it, you'll find money. Critical minerals, most of it, in Africa. Superpower rivalry, and that's a political angle there. But even there, why is there a superpower rivalry being played, a great power rivalry being played at Pakistan, for example? Pakistan holds the critical minerals. They hold the kind of critical minerals which are rare. And anybody, having influence in Pakistan are going to get hold of the critical minerals which are being used in the defense technology, the future technologies, all of them, right? At the end of the day, it's all about money.
Isn't it like the military's there almost like the sort of mafia threat? What you're saying is, look, if you don't, we can do this. That seems to me a lot about what you're trying to imply there, mate.
Yeah, well, Tony, the thing is that democracy is the key. Majority rule, fine. Democracy is not perfect, but where there are democracies, the politicians have to consider people's opinion, all right, because they have to go back to the elections. But a country like Pakistan, where generals are ruling, I don't know, it was Churchill who said the war is too serious a business to be left to the generals?
That's Lloyd George.
No, like Lloyd George said it. Yeah, I stand corrected.
Okay, well,
so the generals, if the people, the non-democratic forces, if they're in charge, they have to be controlled. And in a way, America is controlling was controlling the Pakistani generals, but now the Chinese are trying to take over, and China is not a democracy, but even they don't want a nuclear catastrophe in their backyard, and Pakistan and India is their backyard.
Well, they want is a market.
Well, India is a bigger market like that, 1.3 billion people.
Yeah. Yeah. So maybe that's why they're favouring the Indians. Anyway, look, let's have a listen now to King Charles's big opponent on the map of the world, the guy he's going nose to nose with, by the name of Vladimir Putin.
Today, we're all united by feelings of joy and grief, pride and gratitude, bowing deep to the generation that crushed Nazism, paying the price of millions of lives for the freedom and peace for entire humankind. We faithfully preserve the memory of those historic, triumphant events. And as heirs to winners, we celebrate the holiday of the 9th of May as the biggest for our country, for the whole nation, for every family, for every one of us. Our fathers, our grandfathers and great-grandfathers saved our motherland and call upon us to defend our homeland and be strong in defending our national interests, our thousand-year-long history, culture, and traditional values. Everything that we hold dear, everything that we hold sacred, we remember the lessons of World War II, and we will never agree with disrupting its history, with attempts at justifying the perpetrators. Our duty is to defend the honor of soldiers and officers of the Red Army and their great feat done by representatives of different nationalities that will forever remain in world history as Russian soldiers. Russia has been and will be a barrier in the way of Nazism, Russophobia, anti-Semitism. Russia will continue to fight atrocities perpetrated by followers of those destructive ideas. Truth and justice are on our side. The entire country, the whole society, the whole nation support the participants of the special military operation. We are proud of their bravery, the strength of spirit that has always brought us nothing but victory. Dear friends, the Soviet Union took the brunt of the fierce blows of the enemy. Millions of people who had known only peaceful labor took up arms and stood strong on all the heights and all the borders, determining the outcome of the entire World War II with their undisputed victories in the biggest battles under Moscow and Stalingrad at the Bulge of Kursk. The courage of defendants of Belarus, who were the first to meet the enemy. Defendants of the Brest Fortress and Mogilev, Odessa and Sevastopol, Murmansk, Tula, Smolensk. The heroism of the people of besieged Leningrad. The courage of those who fought on battle lines in partisan units and in the underground. The courage of those who under enemy fire evacuated factories and worked in the rear. The plans of the Nazis to conquer the Soviet Union met the resilience of the country and the heroism of the people. All the republics bore the burden of the war.
So that's Vladimir Putin, Russian president, speaking earlier today in Red Square as part of their victory celebrations for what they call Victory Day in World War II. I played a lot more there than of King Charles, because his was more of a sort of, I suppose, friendly and actually quite jokey speech. Putin sounds a lot more serious in that he's talking about specific actions in the Second World War, and most importantly is that he's also talking about according to him, the threat of the Nazis is still out there.
Yeah, well, it's quite, imagine the hypocrisy there. I mean, he's already involved in an active conflict with the Ukraine. I know there are, I mean, everybody's got their own point of view there. But if you look at what they're doing, I mean, if you look what they did in Crimea, the way they instigated this war, and Ukrainians ultimately had to go out and defend themselves. They didn't have a choice. So they went ahead and fought back, and what had resulted in hundreds of thousands of casualties, as we know. So listening to what Putin has to say, and if you're comparing it with King Charles, King Charles' heart seems to be in the right place, and he's talking about the modern world the way it is, and he sees it the way it is, actually. So you can relate with what he's saying, but what Putin is saying, he's still living in the past, like my generals in my country living in the past, typical of authoritarian state. I know it might not be very popular opinion talking from an anti-establishment point of view, but whatever he's saying would have meant, would have been more meaningful if he would not have been doing what he's doing right now in Ukraine. Don't you think so?
Martin, what do you make of Putin's speech?
Well, I mean, we're obviously not necessarily going to agree about this, but that's okay. We're not here to agree about things all the time. The conflict in the Ukraine started in the Maidan Square in 2014 when there was a coup d'etat and the pro-EU demonstrators were all shot in the head, and six police officers were also shot in the head by a professional sniping team.
Yeah, but if you wind it on a little bit, the Russians did invade Ukraine, didn't they?
Hang on, Tony, let me just put the background in here. The coup in 2014, the Ukraine was a unified state. There was an elected president, Yanukovych, a Russian speaker, because half the population are Russian speakers. Most people in East Ukraine don't speak any Ukrainian at all because they're not Ukrainians. Yeah?
So when did the state of Ukraine actually get created?
It got created in 1991 in the breakup of the Soviet Union.
I mean, it's an important thing, in, as you know, from Pakistan and India. The way you draw the lines in peacetime isn't always the way they should be drawn.
It's similar in a way, because the breakup of the Soviet Union was like the creation of India and Pakistan. It was a disorderly thing. Yeah. And Ukraine became, the Ukrainians, actually, there was a vote, Gorbachev had a vote, shall we break up the USSR? And in actual fact, a majority of people in the then USSR voted to keep the USSR. But as Gorbachev got undermined by various internal struggles that were going on, eventually the USSR was broken up by Yeltsin, by Lukashenko, who was still in power in Belarus, and I can't remember the name of the guy in charge of the Ukraine at the time, Kuchma, possibly. So they became separate countries. But this was in a disorderly fashion. And don't forget, the Ukraine, the borders of the Ukraine, were set in the first place by Lenin, and he made sure that there weren't too many, it wasn't a Ukrainian majority, so he put loads of Russian speakers in the east into the Ukraine. Crimea only became part of the Ukraine in 1954.
I knew you were going to mention Crimea, because the British have had their eye on Crimea
since the 1850s.
So anyway, he's talking there, Martin. We've got to also look at today.
Yes,
he's as well as World War II. He does make a statement there about really saying basically that we won the Second World War. I mean, looking at the casualty figures, I'm not sure about the Americans. The British, we lost about 350,000 in World War II, in civilians and soldiers. The Russians lost over 25 million. So it was even though we started we actually declared war on Germany in 1939, and we were fighting for much longer than them. The Russians lost, something like 80 times more than we did.
Yeah, I don't think Russians in general, and Putin in particular, want to say that they won the war on their own. In fact, previously, and before this conflict over Ukraine broke out, and even after it had broken out, Putin came to the Normandy memorials for the D-Day landings, and he had a word with Hollande, who was the French president at the time, and with Merkel, who was the German chancellor. And he said,
"This is before he invaded Ukraine."
This was after the coup, and you'd got a ceasefire. The Minsk agreement—they fixed the Minsk agreements, which was that Crimea, which was only put into Ukraine in 1954 by Khrushchev in a drunken meeting. The same problems happened in Yugoslavia, of course, because the internal borders in Yugoslavia were created by the communists. So when you say this is our state over here, the communists created that state and they decided who was going to be in it. Now, I'm not saying it's easy, it's messy, but I'm just saying that, Putin, he's got all these world leaders there with him.
Martin, if you allow me to ask question.
Yeah, you two, do please have a little chit-chat.
Do you think Putin has been elected by the people of Russia?
Yes.
Really? And what about all those opposition leaders who just, mysteriously get murdered on the streets of Moscow? Leader,
Cathy McCarthy was probably going to be the president of Ireland. She was 23 years old when she was assassinated in the bar of Queen's University in Belfast. Her own side saw her as a future president of the country, but she was murdered.
Well, what's that got to do?
That mean that we're not a democracy? We are, kind of. But there's still messy stuff.
Yeah, but
the big opposition in Russia to Putin comes from the Communist Party of the Russian Federation, Zyuganov. And he was going to win the election in 1998, as everybody all over Eastern Europe, the communists, won the second election.
Well, Martin,
happened in Russia, but it didn't.
Adil.
How can you call somebody a democratically elected leader if anybody who stands in his opposition gets killed?
Well, that's happened in this country. Gerry Adams was nearly assassinated twice. Does that mean it's not a democratic country?
No, no. I think he's talking about in Russia.
No, I know. But I'm making the point.
Where these various opposition leaders have been assassinated.
Yeah, but non-mainstream leaders, they can't...
Navalny has never been elected to anything, ever. When he did stand for election, he got a risible vote. The big opposition in Russia is Zyuganov and the Communist Party. They are the second biggest party. And if they came to power, they've got a harder line on the Ukraine than the United Russia Party. Inside Russia itself, Putin is regarded as a moderate. Medvedev, who used to be the president, is more extreme than Putin. The middle class and the moderates vote for Putin because, in actual fact, he's not an extremist in the way that the West presents.
What other options have they got?
They've got the Communist Party of the Russian Federation. When Navalny ran this thing where he said, we're going to set up a website in Moscow where we'll show you who can beat Putin's party. Yeah? So we'll tell you who to vote for. And the paper that it came up, all the people to vote for if you want to stop Putin's party, is the Communist Party. The Communist Party were opposed to the privatisation in the 1990s. Putin was eventually... What they've done is they've got a nationalised arms industry, for example. We haven't got that. What we've got is a rubbish arms industry which can't actually keep up, because it's not actually run by military people.
If you look at approval ratings, Putin's approval rating in Russia is very high.
Absolutely.
Does that mean he's doing that propaganda?
Well, it's because when people are at war, they tend to rally round the leadership. Mm. The Russian speakers in the East Ukraine, the Odessa massacre was carried out, yeah? Thugs from Kiev came and massacred 48 people in the trade union hall in 2014, and that's what led to Donetsk and Luhansk republics breaking away and having a referendum to leave Ukraine. Well, let's Slovenia broke out of Yugoslavia in 1991.
I'd be interested to hear what Adil's got to say about potential peace in Ukraine, because we had Boris Johnson on earlier on, who famously in 23 in April, flew out to Istanbul to basically nobble the peace agreement.
No, he flew to Kiev.
I thought it was in Istanbul.
No, it was in Kiev. The Istanbul thing was later.
Yeah. Anyway, so Boris Johnson played quite a major role in making sure that peace agreement wasn't signed by promising Zelensky, it's okay, you know, you can carry on and we will help you, etc. But what are your thoughts about possibilities for peace between the EU, Britain and the Russians in Ukraine? Because it is a kind of proxy war. A lot of the Ukrainians are being supported by the Europeans.
I think the first time in the post-colonial world order, there has been a real disagreement between the US and their Marshall Plan beneficiaries. First time ever with the kind of policies President Trump has brought in. There are open disagreements here in the UK and in the Europe as well. And the Europeans are doing something about it. So Europeans wants to go their own way. Of course, Putin wants the critical minerals of... President Trump wants the critical minerals. And Putin does not want that to happen. So there are a lot of, again, as I was mentioning earlier, moving parts there. At the end of the day, I think the deciding factor of the Ukraine resolution would be with Moscow on board and with the European Union on board. Americans are already sitting across the Atlantic first, and secondly, they're looking inwards. They want to build their own infrastructure, and they are definitely losing clout in the world, and they're losing clout to China, again, great power rivalry. And the Chinese are coming and offering very profitable deals to the Europeans, to the UK as well. So,
we had President Xi sitting there in Red Square today, despite the fact that Zelensky had threatened to bomb the mark. I mean, I was quite amazed at the weekend that Zelensky had the temerity to say, oh, well, you're going to have your big celebration on Friday. We might just decide we want to bomb you. But they were all sitting there, including President Xi. What seems to be happening is the China and Russia are being coming very close together here.
Yeah, well, it's way above Zelensky's pay grade to bomb that Moscow. And once President Xi is sitting there, and, well, you know, President Trump also doesn't want that. So I think, well, he's just, I would say, we're talking about proxies, you know. He's a sort of a proxy, the way the world sees it, the way he's being portrayed.
Sorry, who's a proxy?
Well, the way Zelensky's been portrayed, he's been portrayed, you know.
He seems to have been sort of hired for the job, you know, like an actor in a Hollywood
film.
He
was an actress, actually. He was an actor, actually, yeah.
So. He was an actress?
Yeah. Actor, yeah.
Well, he used to do stuff in drag as well.
He played a role as an actress, so that's why, you know, I mixed it up.
Yeah, well, I mean, maybe he still is. Who knows? Anyway, fascinating chat between you two. Lucky we're just doing a bit of jaw-jawing here, not war-warring. No fisticuffs, no blows, no bruises, nothing like that. But anyway, fascinating to hear both of your take on that particular conflict. But we're going to go down to something which I personally believe is more serious now in Gaza. And we have a report this week from Northern Gaza, exclusive report from Fatima, who's having to suffer now with a rather horrific taking away of aid, food supplies, water, medical facilities. So here's Fatima speaking to me, recorded yesterday in Northern Gaza.
Hello, this is Fatima reaching out to you from a corner of a freedom in Northern Gaza under the Zionist occupation forces' most intense reporting restrictions in human history. The humanitarian situation in Gaza continues to deteriorate at an alarming pace. Palestinians are facing extreme hunger due to severe restrictions imposed by Israel occupation, which are obstructing the entry of vital humanitarian aid into the besieged enclave. The complete devastation of Gaza is unfolding in plain view of the world. Each day brings in new atrocities, starvation, lack of clean water, blocked aid, the rampant spread of disease, a tick-tock genocide. Children are among the most severely affected. Haunting images of them crying out in hunger, pleading for the blockade to be lifted, have emerged as symbols of the crisis. Daily, desperate families gather around charity kitchens, hoping to receive even a minimal portion of food amid a tightening siege and escalating famine. According to UNRWA, Israeli forces are employing starvation as a weapon of war, aiming to impose political and military changes in Gaza through collective punishment. The majority of Gaza's civilians now face forced starvation. There is no baby formula, no medication for pregnant women, and no access to basic health care. This inhumane policy extends beyond the Gaza Strip and its residents. As Palestinian detainees in Israeli prisons under the authority of far-right Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir, known for his racist rhetoric, are also subjected to horrific conditions, systematic torture, medical neglect, isolation, and severe shortages of food and water. In Gaza, residents are surviving on a single meal or less per day, with acute shortages of flour, rice, infant formula, and clean water. All of this unfolds amid deepening international silence. The use of starvation and deprivation as a weapon against Gaza's civilian population constitutes a grave violation of international humanitarian law. The blockade and closure of border crossings have caused a catastrophic collapse of health infrastructure and widespread malnutrition, especially among children and infants. According to the Medical Aid for Palestinians, the failure of the international community, including the UK, to end the chronic impunity afforded to Israel for its ongoing atrocities, including systematic attacks on health infrastructure and personnel, and the use of starvation as a weapon of war, has brought us in the brink of institutionalizing a humanitarian dystopia. The UK must not be an ally to these atrocities. Despite the presence of over 3,000 aid trucks waiting at the border, loaded with essential supplies, Israeli authorities continue to deny entry. As 2.3 million Palestinians endure forced starvation and resist an ongoing genocide, reports have emerged of a Gaza-bound humanitarian aid ship being bombed by drones while in international waters near Malta. The Freedom Flotilla, carrying 30 international human rights activists, was reportedly attacked twice by what are believed to be Israeli drones and left severely damaged. Malta, in a breach of international obligations, failed to respond. This attempt to obstruct humanitarian aid is a deliberate act of war against a starving population. The international community must urgently act. It must impose sanctions on Israel, end its impunity, and compel it to allow unrestricted humanitarian access to Gaza. The blockade must be lifted, and the use of starvation as a weapon against civilians must be condemned and stopped. Thank you.
So that's Fatima reporting exclusively for this show on from northern Gaza. That's the first show, first report she's done, Martin, where you haven't heard the buzzers.
Previously, people who are regular listeners to the show will know that when we've had Fatima, you can hear the drones overhead all the time.
And all you can hear in the background there was kids playing. So, you know, maybe this is a good sign. I don't know. Anyway, Adil, what do you make of this conflict? 3,000 vehicles loaded with aid being prevented from entering.
Well, Tony, a lot has been said about the politics of it, about what Hamas is doing, what the Israelis is doing. It's quite simple, it's unanimous, globally unanimous decision that there are gross human rights violations by Israel against the Palestinian people, especially in Gaza, going on right now. And I mean, that's why the International Court of Justice have, you know, criminalized and given a verdict against Benjamin Netanyahu. I mean, that's all said and done, but being a Muslim, I will question the cold-hearted hypocrisy of the Muslim Ummah, Muslim world, especially the kingdoms in the Middle East, who's got the financial wherewithal to force, at least force the food and aid trucks into Gaza to feed them. All right, they can do that, but instead they are doing joint military exercises with Israel. So that speaks of the kind of hypocrisy which really, you know, there's no explanation of it. And of course, yeah, there is the sectarian divide in the Muslim world is being played there, and it is being said that Hamas is being supported by Iran. But when it comes to common interests, like in the case of India and Pakistan, both the Iranian ministers and the Saudi ministers were at New Delhi and Islamabad. They're trying to negotiate a deal between India and Pakistan. So they're cooperating where they need to. But once it comes to Gaza, it comes to Palestine, well, they find their hands tied. Why? That's the biggest million-dollar question. I'm questioning my own people. Why are you quiet about it? Why are you letting the children of Gaza, you know, suffer in hunger? Why are you doing that?
I mean, isn't it possible from a military point of view to airdrop aid in?
Well, no, it's only
they've done it already. I mean, the Jordanians, actually the Brits, I think, have been doing this in the past.
Well, they can do that, and if the Brits are involved, if Britain is involved, the Israelis won't risk, you know, shooting them down. But if Jordan is also cooperating with Israel, maybe they do it or maybe they don't, because the people, there are talks going on. There is this rock star, Sufi rock star. His name is Dr. Salman Ahmed. He's American based. His group is called Janoon. And he did a show with me a few days ago, last week, in fact. And he said that there are plans that the people in Gaza, as per President Trump's plan, are to be moved, and one third of them are to be taken in by Pakistan. At the same time, the Pakistani military has cleared a delegation, although they do not acknowledge Israel, but they have sent a special delegation to Israel to normalize ties with them. So there's a lot of talk going on that to displace the people from Gaza, and President Trump's plan that he wants to develop it.
Another piece of news this week is that allegedly there is a bit of a rift between Netanyahu and Trump. Donald Trump is getting a little bit fed up with Benjamin Netanyahu because he is trying to get the Americans to encourage and force some sort of war with Iran. Martin, do you know anything about this? Trump apparently is disappointed with Netanyahu. He's excluded Israel, for example, from regional plans. This is just yesterday. Tensions escalating between Trump and Netanyahu as the former president moves forward with Middle East plans.
Well, I don't think that to call things a plan is a bit, to exaggerate a bit. I think people are feeling their way forward and trying to find out what might and might not work, and Trump's definitely in that category. So, of course, when the ceasefire broke down, because the Israelis broke it, the recent ceasefire, which was, you know, that you've got to withdraw from Gaza, you've got to allow humanitarian aid in, and we've got to negotiate the second phase, and then we'll release all the hostages. The Israelis, through that, you know, they without warning...
Well, we can faff around all we want. Why can't we just airdrop some aid in?
Because it won't solve the problem, Tony. In any case, the Israelis don't want to be there, they'll shoot you down.
People are not starving tonight, right. Tomorrow, this okay. Weekend, won't it?
Well, let's just go back to what you asked, the question you asked me about, which is what's happened. What's happened is in Yemen... What's happened is because the ceasefire broke down, then the Yemenis restarted their campaign against the Israelis. They'd called it off, because that's because while the ceasefire is on, we will not be firing rockets at you, yeah? Because they're trying to encourage a ceasefire. That's what the Yemenis
Trump is said
for.
To be, this is just quoting here, Trump is said to be furious over what he perceives as an Israeli attempt to pressure his former national security advisor, Mike Waltz, into supporting military action against Iran.
Yes, well... Let me get to. I'll try and be brief.
What Trump is saying is, look, I'm in charge. If you want something done, come to me. Don't go and try and put pressure on my minor cabinet members because you think that if you ask me, I'll say no. He's getting annoyed with Netanyahu.
Well, there's been a truce between the Yemenis and the Americans, which also includes the British, I presume, because we've been involved in this as well. We were bombing from Akrotiri last week. But what they've agreed is that, and Trump has spun this as they don't want to fight with us anymore, and they've agreed that they won't fire at American ships, and we won't fire at them anymore, even though they killed loads of civilians inside Yemen. And that's because the Yemeni military have defeated the British Royal Navy and the United States Navy. Both aircraft carriers have now run out of missiles to fire, and they've had to withdraw. And that, but of course, the Yemenis are still allowed to attack Israeli targets. They attacked Ben Gurion Airport while this was going on. Now, this is very significant.
I think quite a lot of airlines, Martin, have now stopped flying
that's
to
right.
Tel Aviv.
Anyway, and that's going to go on.
I do want to come in there.
Yeah,
well, Tony, this disagreement between Netanyahu and President Trump, I believe that these are just optics because, it has happened before as well. So President Trump has already said what he wanted to do, and they've got to manage the public perception about it. Otherwise, in my personal opinion and in the opinion of the American themselves, well, Israel, the political system in America is being practically run by Israel through the, through the monetary wealth of the managed by APEC, you know,
APEC.
So
American Israel Public Affairs Committee, Israel lobby.
Yeah. So, do you think President Trump would have been elected? I mean, he's the one who moved the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. What do you expect? So, I think these are on mere optics. But whatever is happening in this world, right, the great divide in this world. I'll just say this: I heard it in 2004 in the Hyde Park speaker. Corner, there was this guy. He said,
well, he's an ex Hyde Park speaker, aren't you, Martin?
Really? That might have been you, Martin. You know, well, I still remember that in 2004. I was a young captain and I was visiting my family here in London. So, this gentleman said that, listen, the great divide in this world is not based on religion and not based on nationalities, not based on the color of your skin, not based on geography. It is based on those at the top and rest all beneath them. So those are the top 1%, right? The one who's got the money, and who keeps on making more and more and more, right? The global corporations, right? They're the one who are actually in control. They're the one who are deciding. Now, you know who's controlling them, who are the real owners. So they're actually calling the shots, and we are only, you know, we're the pawns.
Rock.
We have pawns in the game, and that's all I'll say. Yeah, well, of course, you know that.
So another aspect to the war in Gaza came very much home to Britain, to London, I believe, earlier this week, with a concerted effort by Palestine Solidarity Campaign at the annual general meeting of Barclays Bank.
Barclays is funding Israel's genocide in Palestine!
Barclays is a primary dealer of Israel government bonds. It's helping Israel fund its atrocities against Palestinians. Barclays invests billions and provides loans worth billions to arms companies that are arming Israel's attacks against Palestinians. Shame on you, Nigel! Shame on you!
They're building the armored bulldozers that are tearing down Palestinian homes. Tens, if not hundreds of thousands of Palestinians have been killed by the genocide. This ATM should not be going on while you're bank crawling, genocide and death. You've got blood on your hands. Shame on you! Shame on you!
Free Palestine!
Now, for all of those Barclays Bank shareholders who were attending that meeting, it was rather wonderfully organised. They had two people stood up on their chairs and started shouting in the middle of the AGM. And then once they were grabbed, two in a different area stood up and they started shouting. And then they were starting running out of security guards to get rid of them. And then once those people had been removed, another two stood up. And then once they'd been removed, there was about 20 people all stood up in one big block that they couldn't get rid of. So it was a fantastic piece of disruption of an annual general meeting. Is there really any point to this sort of thing, Martin, do you think?
Well, as long as we've got a record of it, which we've got, and we can use it. I mean, if it happened and we didn't even know about it and we haven't got a record
of
it...
Well, of course, they're filming that. Of course, they're not showing this on the BBC, but...
No, but we can use it.
What do you think of this sort of tactic?
Tony, but when something is already on the internet, it's not going down. Firstly, thanks God, I don't have a Barclays account. None of my family's got. But, Tony, the important thing to note over here is that these kind of displays, they were not quite common. All right. I live in London, all right, and the suburbs of London. I would see regular protests being carried out by white British people. I'd say that all of you gentlemen here are white British people. So it was never considered a problem of the white British or white people, all right? But I would say white people, I mean, my people, they support it financially fine and they would be staying in the background because then they're labeled and they're prosecuted and they're penalized, right? But now the privileged class, which we say have got the white advantage, they are coming forward and they're speaking about it. And it is, and it's happening in the US as well, in the UK as well. This is something which is a new phenomenon. And I think that is where the hope lies.
Also, we had Mark Pritchard, who's a Conservative MP. He stood up in the House of Commons this week to talk about Gaza.
Deputy Speaker, of course, Israel is an important security, trade and democratic partner, but that doesn't give it a blank cheque. The fact is that 13,000 children have been killed, 25,000 have been injured, maimed, wounded, orphaned, some of them. And for many years, I've been in this House 20 years, I have supported Israel pretty much at all costs, quite frankly. But today, I want to say that I got it wrong. And I condemn Israel for what it is doing to the Palestinian people in Gaza and indeed in the West Bank. And I'd like to withdraw my support right now for the actions of Israel, what they are doing right now in Gaza. Of course the hostages should be released. Of course that Israel has a right to exist. Of course the Israeli people, the Jewish people, should have the right to live in peace. But so do the Palestinian people. Yeah. And I've said it before and I'll say it again, that the life of a Palestinian child is as precious as the life of a Jewish child. And this particular moment in time, we've had lots of statements over the last 18 months, this is not only this Parliament's not greatest hour. I'm really concerned that this is a moment in history when people look back where we've got it wrong as a country. Yeah. Can the minister stand up to our friends and allies in the United States and make a strong stand for humanity? For us being on the right side of history, for having the moral courage to lead, not just to follow the United States, and to make a difference. That's why we're all elected here. Let's stand up for life. Let's stand up for all children, not just Jewish children.
So Mark Pritchard, MP there, speaking out. Adil, you were talking about the sort of Islamic Muslim aspect to this, but really what he's saying there is this is just about humanity. It doesn't matter whether you're any religion or none. Everyone should be on the side of the Palestinians in this dispute.
So Tony, when have you heard such speeches in the House of Commons? When was the last time you heard a white MP speaking about this?
As a Conservative MP.
As a Conservative MP, yeah. So at the end of the day, I mean, this is a big change, the change which we are witnessing now. Mm. People are speaking up about it. I talk to people in the US, they are talking about it. People in the UK are talking about it. And mainstream, I was advised by my solicitors once I was going through this counterterrorism investigation on the complaint of the Pakistani state that to not talk about the Palestine issue because then you'll be labeled and you'll be politically persecuted as well. But within a year, I mean, that was 2023, right? Within 1.5 years, I see things changing for the better. And that's where I see hope for humanity, of course. It's not a religious issue. It's at the end of the day an issue of a common humanity. And if we are not human, and if there is no humanity left, then what good is this world?
Well, there is a bit of humanity left, and one of the humans is called Louis Theroux. He goes for the BBC all around the place talking to people, and he's just done another programme chit-chatting with Israeli settlers.
The godmother of the settler project, going back more than 50 years, is the woman I'd seen at the Gaza border event, Daniela Weiss.
I want to see big cities here. Like a city of 2 million people. So it's not a settlement. Settlement is caravans, is trailers, is a home here and a home there. This is not what my dream is about.
The trailers in that video of Daniela have now grown into the settlement of Kedumim, where she still lives.
Hi.
Adam and Salim.
Supported by some in the Israeli government, Daniela is viewed by others in power as a dangerous extremist. She'd agreed to talk to me at home.
Nice to see you. So we've got pictures of you as a young woman. Is the one of you getting married, is that the oldest one?
This is when we got together. I was then 15 or something.
Your parents were from...
My mother was born in Warsaw. My parents came here and invested fortunes, believing that someday there will be a Jewish state. Mm-hmm. With their vision and their faith, I continue to expand Israel and to be as close as possible to the promised land.
This is your map. So this is what most of the world knows as the West Bank, which you call Judea and Samaria.
This is what you call occupied West Bank.
And what the Palestinians would like to see is a future state of their own.
Oh, they are not satisfied with this, but complicated issue.
These little pink wedges, what do they represent?
The Jewish communities that were established since 1967.
I'm curious to know roughly how many settlements and outposts you've been, let's say, in some way involved in the establishment.
Almost everyone.
For real?
It's 50 years. Mm-hmm. You know what it means, 50 years, that I do what I do today?
Because it's territory that was won in the 67 war, that under the Geneva Convention, transferring a civilian population into a conquered terrain, that's considered a war crime.
This, what I do here is a war crime.
According
and
to
you're
the UN.
Cooperating with the person who committed war crime?
Well, I'm interviewing you.
It's a light felony.
A war crime or a light felony, Martin? What do you think?
A war crime or a light
felony? That's what she says, she calls it.
All right, because he's been... Well, I mean, Louis Theroux... Obviously, as you know, pretty good
job.
What
I'll do is I'll put a link up to the full audio of the program on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. You'll also have, if you want to listen to the full Putin speech, the full King Charles speech as well, that'll all be up there. But this is the sort of thing the BBC get a lot of criticism. In fact, they have Palestine Solidarity Campaign protests outside there, but they do come out with the goods sometimes.
Well, that's right, but it's so difficult for them because they're under intense lobbying, from the British government, the Israelis lobby, and so on. So the film that they made about children in Gaza, they had to withdraw it, didn't they? Because it turned out that the young boy who was speaking, his father was a minister in the Hamas government, and therefore it's just propaganda for Hamas. And of course, it happened
that this boy was one of the best English speakers.
Well, that's right, because he was an educated. His father was a technocrat,
and they were making the film in English.
When he was a minister,
so the decision
was
made
agricultural development
based on the language of the guy speaking.
That's right. I mean, they were forced to take it down because if anybody's worked for the BBC, as you have, Tony, you will know, like Jonathan Cook, who's based in Bristol, he used to work for The Guardian, and he can't get any mainstream, you know, he's very solid on Palestine.
But still, Tony, this is what I was talking about earlier, the change, you know, and the change in the last 1 or 1.5 years. This is not something very small. This is a very subtle but a big change coming in the narratives, in the Western narratives. BBC playing this documentary, Valui Taru, that itself is, you know, a brave step, I would say. But this is a departure from the previous policy. We must acknowledge that as well.
Look, I think we ought to also acknowledge, I mean, Netanyahu this week has been talking about he's got a war on 7 fronts in Gaza, the West Bank, Syria, Yemen, Iran, Iraq, Lebanon. Is that 7? Yeah. I mean, is it feasible for the Israelis to fight a war on these 7 fronts?
Well, if you believe in the philosophy or the theories of Greater Israel, then it's already happening, isn't it? But, well, lands are the first casualty in the war, so let's see.
Well, they can try. Let's see if they fold. It was very interesting to hear there's quite a lot of pressure being put on by senior people in Israel for the youngsters not to go and sign up for the draft again as they start to recruit people. But let's finish on Gaza just by hearing a little bit of the interface with a government minister. This is, again, our very own Bristol North West, Darren Jones, who's Chief Secretary to the Treasury, being quizzed by some journalists about Gaza.
Is Britain, because we've got this trade deal with India, are we able to turn round to a country like India and ask them to calm down tensions?
Look, I don't think the two issues are connected. It was great we were able to sign this trade deal with India. It's a huge and growing economy, obviously with very significant ties to the United Kingdom and vice versa. It's the biggest trade deal that the UK has been able to sign up to since we left the European Union. And we're thrilled that we've been able to get that across the line. It's good for the UK economy. On the separate issue of tensions and the fact that they're escalating between India and Pakistan, the Foreign Secretary has been in touch with his counterparts in both countries. Evidently, we would rather that was de-escalated and that there was not further conflict in the world. And through our Foreign Office and our Foreign Secretary, we'll continue to try to support both sides to return to a more peaceful situation.
But is Britain's position compromised? I mean, you know, can we turn round to Pakistan and India and say, you know, we want you to bring down tensions and stop this further conflict, where only yesterday Agnes Callamard, she's the head of Amnesty, has accused governments like the UK governments of not using their degree of influence and keep tiptoeing around the reality in Gaza, and she refers to what's happening there as a genocide. So how can the UK have any power over Pakistan and India? Say, hey, listen, can you stop sending these bombs across the border when we are selling arms to Israel, who are accused by some very serious organisations of a genocide?
Quite a few complicated issues in your question there. I mean, the first point is, can the UK tell any country around the world what to do? Of course not. We have diplomats through the diplomatic channels where we try to support peace and cooperation and, you know, living by the rules-based order, as you would expect. I think you asked me if there was a conflict between what's going on between India and Pakistan and in Israel and Gaza, and you asked me about arms exports. You know that we have restricted arms exports to Israel where there has been evidence of those weapons being used in breach of the conditions.
So that's his answer, sort of shilly-shallying around there. Let's now have a listen. There's another piece of news, important piece of news this week, about the arrests of a whole bunch of Iranians. So let's have a listen to that.
Has been speaking in the past hour about the arrests of seven Iranian nationals across England in separate counter-terrorism operations. Eight men in total were detained yesterday. Detectives are still trying to establish the nationality of the remaining suspect. Ms. Cooper said the operations reflected the challenges facing national security. Our investigations correspondent, Daniel De Simone, reports from Scotland Yard.
The counter-terrorism team used explosives to gain entry to the Rochdale premises.
Guards, dog unit, everything.
Whoa, bomb!
A man was arrested there, as well as in Manchester, London, Swindon and Stockport. Four of the five men were Iranian nationals. The police say this was a pre-planned investigation into a plot to target a specific premises.
Well, that specific premises has now been allegedly, if we can say it, named as the Israeli embassy. Martin, what do you make of this one?
Well, I'll be honest with you, my first instinct around this is that this is political theatre. We're on the brink. We've been at war with Yemen for several months now, although that now seems to have stopped because of the agreement that's been made between Trump and Nasrullah. But, of course, the US, the British Navy, the Royal Navy, the two aircraft carriers, one's going down towards Diego Garcia, the other one is already there, and we're preparing, as Trump said, if they don't sign up to what we're going to do, we're going to bomb Iran.
So if Trump
and we will also be involved in bombing Iran.
Trump
so this is preemptive action by the deep state here to plant the seed in people's minds. The Iranians are going to blow things up. And, of course, why do you need to have explosives and dogs and military, it wasn't just police, military in full gear to address one guy, and they're all separate, they're all in different places. Now, the implication must be that the Iranian secret services have infiltrated these Iranians in who are about to attack the Israeli embassy. In 1982, there was an attack on the Israeli embassy, and two Palestinians, whose names I've forgotten, were convicted for it. But Dave and Annie, who are ex-MI5 officers that we know, they know that they were fitted up. The attack on the Israeli embassy was carried out by Israel, and on the back of that, they then invaded Lebanon. Okay? So I just suspect this. Now, the whole point of having a rule of law is we want to see them in court,
evidence. The thing I struggle with is what would Iran possibly gain by attacking the Israeli embassy in London?
They wouldn't, just like the Russians wouldn't gain anything by poisoning Skripal. Then that's a, you know.
Adil, anyway, what do you make of this? This is quite a big story this week. We were told very little about it, but then just I think yesterday, there was an unofficial announcement that it was the Israeli embassy apparently these guys were after.
Yeah, well, Tony, I would tend to agree with Martin over here because it sounds fishy once Israel is lobbying America to attack Iran, and there's a lot of talk going on about it, and at the same time you find this Iranian national trying to plot a terrorist act here against the Israeli embassy, maybe fine, but what has Iran got to gain from it? Iran is already under a lot of pressure, from pure realpolitik point of view, it really doesn't make any sense. From a conspiracy theory point of view, it does make sense that it was a false flag. And what Martin says, well, in my personal opinion, I think that makes a lot of sense.
I mean, could it simply be that the Israelis have just said to the counter-terrorism command and Scotland Yard, these guys are up to something?
I don't think that this level of conspiracy could be hashed, but you can definitely provide, like the Pakistanis, for over years, like in my case, they provide false, if my country's intelligence agency, likewise Mossad is trying to, like ISI, like Mossad is giving some kind of information to MI6 or MI5, like in my case, they gave them an information that I'm a terrorist, right? They had to get me arrested. They had to send the counterterrorism police. The good thing is that they took 9 months, of investigation, and they cleared me, all right? I'm speaking out of personal experience. So if Mossad is giving some kind of information like this to the MI6, MI5, they have to act.
Yeah. They have to, because what if they don't and something goes wrong?
This is really
bouncing them into it. Okay, well, our final clip tonight is from someone called Alexander Dugin. He's a philosopher, apparently, over in Russia. His daughter was murdered by the Ukrainians, assassinated by the Ukrainians. She was a journalist. And he's been talking to RT. I mean, I try... Ever since RT was banned, I keep sort of curiously going to have a look on Rumble at RT and various other through using VPN to look at RT to see what's going on, because quite obviously our own Ofcom and our government don't want us to see it. Well, why not? Because the Russians have got their point of view. They've also got their philosophers who are talking about what they think is really going on in the world.
Which leader, non-Russian, do you most admire around the world right now?
So I admire Xi Jinping. I think he's a great leader. He transformed the growth and the rise of China in something very stable. So he has used his participation in the globalization, but to the favor of its own country. So he is wise master, number one, I think, who could combine participation, liberalism, and globalism, and at the same time to make China really great.
Okay.
So that was the art. Second person, I would say, I don't speak about Putin because we have spoken about him. I admire him as well. Obviously, we have spoken of him. But outside of Russia, I admire Modi. I think Modi is very, very, very great leader. He tries to make India great again. He tries to concentrate the possibility of inner growth of huge Indian society in order to consolidate civilization and political sovereignty. And Donald Trump, I would say. Okay. I like Donald Trump because at least he started to fight against the worst that we could imagine, because against this Kamala core, against this Biden, against this globalist in United States, because before Trump, United States, in my eyes, was worst thing at all. That was the bottom line of the history of human degeneration. And Trump is trying to get new dawn to the West. So I appreciate him very much. And I like very much Iranian leader, spiritual leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, who is the living representative that traditional organization of political religious society is still possible in 21st century.
And then conversely, which world leader can't you believe actually got voted in or otherwise as leader of a nation? Who's the worst?
I think that there is the group of the monsters. So the people like ideological leader George Soros, philosophical leader Henri Bernard Lévy, Yuval Harari, economic leader, it is Schwab. They are worst, in my opinion. And political leaders, Keir Starmer, Macron, and Merz, they represent something really awful. So that is insult to the Europe to have such degenerated persons who still lead them.
So that's Alexander Dugin speaking on RT this week. The philosopher, I suppose you'd say, he's a commentator. That chap Hossein, I think it was, we had him last week giving his views on the world stage. So I'm going to give both of you two finally a little chance to say where you think, if anywhere, that we've got some hope lies in the world for the future, because so much of what we report on is depressing, it's upsetting, it looks as if much of the leadership is either compromised or just the wrong people for the job, or they're working for their own interests. So I'll start with you, Martin, actually. Where is there some hope? Where can we look for the light at the end of the tunnel?
Well, I suppose at the end of the day, you've got to work with what you've got. So the list of people who are in charge or possibly in charge, you need to assess them all in terms of how can we cooperate with them if we can find a way to do it. There isn't, I don't believe in having some kind of charismatic leader who solves all the problems. It's not realistic. But if I was going to choose one, I'd probably choose, I've forgotten her name, Motta, I think it is. She's the Prime Minister of Barbados. And they got rid of the monarchy there. And she's agitating for reparations for slavery, which, of course, is now big, getting to be a big deal. It's been picked up by the Jamaicans. It's been picked up in West Africa and so on. So if we can stop World War III, and we've got to stop it, then we will have to cooperate with everybody, including people we don't necessarily like very much or agree with
very much.
Well, you
can't cooperate with the people that want to start it, though.
Well, no, but I mean, the point is, I'm a big fan of the Northern Irish peace process, because people on both sides, both McGuinness and Ian Paisley, they governed the province together in the end, and they did a good job, and they also got people used to the idea of peace.
So you don't believe in the rule of law, you don't think these people should go to jail?
Well, it depends, doesn't it? It depends what they've done. You should always try and find ways to negotiate with people if you can. If you can't,
anyway,
you can't.
We will have, I promise you, Martin, some steak knife next week. Absolutely amazing series, which I'm going to put up on the whole thing, about the British Army's running the IRA nutting squad during the Troubles. But, Adil, final words over to you. Where is the light at the end of the tunnel, if anywhere?
Well, Tony, there is no utopia in this world, and there will always be opposing camps. But once we have had a multipolar world order or a bipolar world order, things used to function, at least. You people had choice, and there was a balance of power. The balance of power got disturbed once there was a unipolar world order, and the things...
Which is the Americans you're talking about.
Yeah, the Americans I'm talking about. Definitely, they're the sole superpower right now, and they're in a great power rivalry with the Chinese, and the Chinese and the Russians, they are cooperating. So if there is a bipolar or multipolar world order, that provides choices to different camps or different warring factions. Yes, people want Third World War, but nobody wants a nuclear catastrophe, because that is not good business at the end of the day. And we've got people, I mean, they want, what at the end of the day, they want to reduce the world population, because that is a problem, and get rid of ailing and aging
that world
population
doesn't vote for them, so let's just get rid of them.
Yeah, well, there are other ways to do that, like we have found during COVID, isn't it? And people are doing that, and I mean, there are so many conspiracy theories around it, but you do not necessarily need to have a third world war to solve the issues, but we definitely do need a balance of power in this world.
Yeah, and let's talk about talk, jaw, not war. That's what we do on here.
Yeah.
It's a war on God, but God's going to win. Time to sign off now, thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, investigative journalist Adil Raja, and also, of course, to our sound engineer, Dave Bazanko, and to Matt O'Brien, who was here earlier on. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please send me interviews and story tips on the Telegram channel and via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll find this podcast, the full-length interviews, story links, and the comment page, and you can subscribe to my free weekly newsletter. If you can afford it, you can even donate or set up a small monthly sub at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'll do my best to sort out the downloading of the app and make a nice page so that it's easy to see how you do it, because without the ads. So this show's repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the talkradio.org.uk stream. Do please make live recordings. We've been streaming live from Bristol at DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and also live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast this show, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5. God bless, and don't let the satanic bansters get you down. Check.
Czechs, they were hip and ting. Two them no know and ting. We have them going and ting. Now pop no style, all strictly roots. Now pop no style, all strictly roots. See me on the road and you no call out to me. Do you see me in my pants and ting? See me in my altar back. Send me gear heart attack. Give me little bass, make me wine on my waist. Uptown top ranking. See me in my Benz and ting. Dolly true constant spring. Them checks say we come from Cosmo Spring. But the true them no know and ting. Them no know say we top ranking. Uptown top ranking. Should I see me and the ranking dread? Check out we jamming and ting. Love is all I bring. In a khaki suit and ting. Now pop no style. I strictly roots. Now pop no style. Watch out with Chucky Danting. In our khaki suit and ting. Love is all I bring. In our khaki suit and ting. Now pop no style. A strictly roots. Now pop no style. A strictly roots.
Feels so worthless. I'm an to see. I love you more than you love me. I love you more than you love me. More than you love me.
I thought I gave up falling in love a long, long time ago. I guess I like it, but I can't tell you. Just to suggest that I'm selfish. I've been trying to impress that more is less and I'm repressed.
I should do it instead.
However I look, it's clear to see. I love you more than you love me. However I look, it's clear to see. I love you more than you love me.
Think about the things that we should have done before. The way that things are going, the end is about to fall. We took the roads that years ago. We took the roads that years ago. We took the roads that years ago. We took the roads that years ago.
You and I.